Thanks, Jen. It's the download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, taking over from Roe and Michael Everett. That what a great performance. That was a lot of fun today. Man, Fridays in at WGN Radio are so fun. Good to see Wendy Snyder as well, too, out of her time slot. I always see Wendy when I have to come in early to do tapings or something like that. But good to see her in the evening light. All right, so we got a great show lined up for you tonight. It's a download. We have a tremendous show lined up. I'm so excited about this. Coming up a little bit later in the program, Mavis Staples joins us. Mavis Staples, the longtime legendary soul singer, part of the Staples Singers and solo project. She's got a new album out with Jeff Tweedy, who wrote and produced it. She's going to be playing the Vic Theater tomorrow night. Everyone's excited for that. She will be on the show tonight to talk about her illustrious career. Also, the show that's coming up tomorrow night, Mavis Staples. Also tonight, Carrie Kennedy, one of Bobby Kennedy's children and the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Foundation, the Human Rights Foundation. She's going to be in town because she's got a new exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. It's a exhibit that's based on her work, her Speak Truth to Power work, where she has been documenting and interviewing human rights activists from all around the world about their work to help with human rights violations and atrocities. And she is bringing the photography and the exhibit to Chicago. And to, I think it's Sunday at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. She is going to be speaking there. And she is joining us tonight beforehand to talk about the exhibit. It's great to have her. Kennedy on the program, Pete. How great is that? And she actually is siblings with Chris Kennedy here in town, who is running for governor. But we won't talk much about that. Also tonight, Cam Davis is going to be here. I'm excited about this. We're going to start a new series here on the download called Air, Land, and Water. And we've been talking about this for the last week or so, just this really take a stock of our natural resources in the area with stories like what's happening in Cape Town, South Africa, or stories about what's once again happening in California as they get ready for drought conditions. It makes you think about what we have and the precious natural resources and what we're doing to protect them here in our area, air, land, and water, with the Metropolitan Planning Council. We've been working with them for 2 years. We did the how to improve segment. So I'm excited. We'll start water tonight. Cam Davis is here. Cam Davis was a senior policy advisor for the EPA and the Obama administration. Great as that. Used to work for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Was really instrumental in protections that were set up for the Great Lakes, particularly Lake Michigan. So we will talk with him about what's going on with our water, our supply, what's being done to protect it, and whether or not the federal government or the state government at this point, or the city government, is doing their job. Cam Davis and Josh Ellis, who will be back from the Metropolitan Planning Council, will join us today, coming up at 7:30. And then we're going to reload this week's news. Biggest stories, winners, losers. Which story is going to be remembered from this week? What story's overreported? What story's underreported? All that coming up. Randy Bellisoma from WGN TV News will be here, as well as Craig Newman. Two regular download reloaders. Not freeloaders, reloaders. There's a difference. all that's coming up tonight. I'm excited for that. That there's so much to talk about. I mean, we'll spend probably the first half hour on the memo alone, and then probably support animals after that. We'll just do. Those two are the big stories in my mind. Memo and support animals. Right in the middle somewhere is where we'll probably land tonight. We have some fun. And a Super Bowl. And put the Super Bowl in there, too. We reached out to Adam Hoge. He's probably at the Chainsmokers show in Minneapolis. Adam Hoge is there all week. He's covering the Super Bowl, Sports Central, the new streaming show that is here at WGN Radio, and he has launched it from Radio Row at the Super Bowl. We want him to check in one more time this week before the Super Bowl starts on Sunday. But we're having a hard time getting a hold of him because he is. I mean, there's probably event after event after event. He's probably at the Chainsmokers, Double Bill, Pink, Sammy Hagar, Styx show. You said, Pete, who's that? There's a bunch of Minnesota bands are playing up there?
Right, yeah. Like all the, you know, the iconic indie rockers are going to, you know, Soul Asylum is doing a show, Bob Mould.
Wow.
A lot of the Prince proteges are hanging around.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. That sounds good. The Prince Proteges. When the Prince Proteges are in the building, you gotta love it. Jen DeSalvo, in for Rob Martyr tonight.
Hello.
Hello. Good to work with you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Are you excited to rock a Friday night?
Yes.
WGN Radio, you are?
Well, because I've only listened to you from the other side, so this is nice.
This is I'm a fan of your work, and I'm happy to work with you. I know you're up on the seventh floor, so we see each other through the screen, but it's always great to have a professional, a veteran Chicago radio personality with you on the night.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so excited about that. Jen will have the news, weather, and traffic. Roger Badishin tonight, of course. Pete Zimmerman's got all the production. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout, so stay with us. All right, it's The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We can get you all night till 11 o'clock, but first, let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Memoies in the corner of my memoies. The big memo has been made public, and so far it's getting bad reviews. The memo suggests that the FBI purposely misled the FISA court to get a warrant to spy on former Trump staffer Carter Page. Congressman Nunes alleges that the FBI knew they had bad intel, but because they loved Hillary so much, they tricked the judge. Did I get it? I think I got it, right? The only problem is that the FISA court doesn't accept three-page memos, and the FBI is saying that it wasn't true, and they if you tell anyone else, they're going to kill you. You know how it goes. It's the FBI. What we know is that what was shaping up as a possible defining moment for the president to prove that his Russian collusion allegations were just a witch hunt seems to be backfiring. Many in the media and the political circles have said that this memo amounts to nothing new, and it's embarrassing, like Geraldo, like Al Capone vault embarrassing. Like reporting smashed grapes with her feet and then falling. Embarrassing. Remember that? Or like Access Hollywood leaked audio embarrassing. A lot of embarrassing there. Can we move on now at least? Can we all come together as a country and move on together? Let the investigation run its course and focus on other memos that can be released for the public good. Since that's what we're doing now, right? I mean, they have to have like, think about the vault, Pete. Think of all the great memos that could be in the FBI if it's all for the public good. I feel like there's a lot. Like, what was the deal with weapons of mass destruction? You ain't got a memo on that? Or, I mean, even go deeper. Who killed Tupac? Or how does the Outback Steakhouse get that onion to bloom so perfectly? You don't have memos on that stuff? I'm on a Tupac, who killed Tupac kick after watching that All Eyes on Me on HBO. I'm so into it now. I'm like, how? It just ends? It's been almost 20 years, 20 plus years, and nobody knows? Really? On the Vegas Strip? What? All right. I'll say this. They say the memo is not about the Mueller investigation. That comes later when the Mueller investigation actually proves the president did something wrong. Then the White House can say, didn't anyone literally get the memo? Literally get the memo? And the markets today didn't react in the way befitting the news that would help the president. The Dow lost 666 points, although let's be fair, it's nothing compared to what's been gained over the past year. But still, what's it mean? Does it mean investors were like, this is it? This is the memo? All right, he's going down. It was good while it lasted. Sell! 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 Actually, they say it's about a strong jobs market. I love that the market reacts poorly when there's good news about the economy. Anyway, it couldn't have been Biggie, and it couldn't have been Puffy. They wouldn't stoop that low. I just feel like there's, if we just spent like 4 hours really trying to deconstruct, unpack what happened to Tupac, we could get somewhere. That's a much more interesting memo. Anyway. A new attack ad on Governor Rauner will be hitting the airwaves soon. It's produced by Jeannie Ives, who's running against Rauner in a GOP primary. It's ludicrous. It depicts a teacher, a protester, a trans person, and a woman with a pink hat all thanking Governor Rauner for letting them be corrupt, be a sanctuary state, use the girls' bathroom, and get abortions. What? It's supposed to be funny, I guess, but it's super cruel, and it reminds many moderate to liberal Illinois residents that you may want to wipe the smirk off your face that Rauner has a challenger. Oh boy, it's offensive. Could you imagine a Democratic ad attacking conservative caricatures like that? I'm a conservative. Look at my pleated khakis. I hate everyone that doesn't look like me. You would never let that. No one would get away with that. Still, with all that being said, I kind of like it. It's got a cute little soundtrack. Boom, boom, boom. The actors are okay. Far be it from me to be the PC police. But it's so absurd that it kind of works. Check it out. Also, I guess a judge has kicked Scott Drury off the ballot running in the Democratic primary for attorney general. He didn't file his statement of economic interest, or he filed the wrong one. He used Form A instead of Form B. He used the EZ form when it should have been the full. Anyway, Drury blames Madigan, and he's going to appeal. I'm sure Madigan had something to do with it. The Sun-Times announced that longtime theater critic Hedy Weiss is out. Her position was eliminated, which is corporate speak for, we have to pay these employees? Weiss was a fixture on the theater scene and ran into some controversy recently, as many in the theater community called her out for personal bias, including insensitivity to works of color. No word if that had anything to do with her termination, but now the Sun-Times doesn't have a theater critic. Sun-Times? Really? That decision? 1.5 stars. Somewhat recommended. In weather, you know how I said it was cool with the cold? Remember when I said that this week? I would like a mulligan. This is awful. This is terrible. What was I thinking? Also, it's going to be below zero for the weekend in Minneapolis where the Super Bowl's at. And snow. But I guess everyone who can afford to go to the Super Bowl has one of those Canadian goose jackets anyway. Right?
Like, Buffy, no, you better get your Canadian goose jacket out of the Lambo.
In sports, we're a week and a half away from baseball starting up, and there's still a handful, if not several handfuls, of star players not signed from this year's free agency class, including Jake Arrieta. Now comes word that some players may stand up for what they assume to be owner collusion and boycott spring training. The thought is that the owners have come together and determined that they don't like the going rate for these star players, and they will just force them to either take less or just not play next season. I don't know about you, but as a fan, I don't have a lot of sympathy for baseball owners having to give a share of their profits to the players. I mean, have you seen how much hot dogs cost? Arrieta should at least get a dollar off of that hot dog. I mean, they're the ones we watch for 162 games. I know that you have gotten some pretty sweet tax breaks for your stadiums over the years, but the fans want home runs, they want swag. And so I'm with the players on this one. I think the owners need to cut this out. Sign Darvish for $175 million and then Arrieta for $150 million. Jake deserves it, not just for his on-field heroics, but for posing naked in ESPN magazine, right? That deserves $150 million. So many leg muscles. So defined, so oiled up. The Hawks lost to Vancouver last night, and according to Chris Bowden, the Hawks have not had a win streak longer than 2 games this year. What? That's not a good stat. Need every game now to get back into the playoff mix, but lost last night. The Northwestern Wildcats, they're on a 2-game win streak, beating Wisconsin last night. Big win. Wisconsin has been better. They're not that great this year, but we'll take it, right? Any chance you can get to beat Wisconsin, you take it. Big rematch with Michigan next. Got to get them all at this point. But that could be it. If they get a little momentum going, they get a Michigan, and they got Michigan State coming up on the... And Maryland as well. Those are quality wins. Pete and I talking about it. You need quality wins. The Bulls play the Clippers in L.A. tomorrow. Will the new Bulls be in tow? Are they there for the game? Allen, Jameer Nelson? Or has everyone all been waived? They just wave them all, and Bulls going to show up with like 3.5 players. Denzel Washington's going to have to play like... What is Valentine? Denzel Valentine's going to have to play 3 different ways. It's like football, but basketball, which they already do play both ways. But he's going to have to play 3 ways. So that's not good. Denzel Valentine. Although it would be a much better Bulls team if Denzel Washington was playing, right? So yeah, who's even on the Bulls anymore? It's February. Any chance you could bring up the D-League guys, like in baseball? You get to August and you're out of it and you're like, let's see what these minor leaguers can do. Can we do that? That would be a fun way to do it. I'd watch at that point. In WNBA news, the Sky are moving to Chicago to the new stadium by McCormick Place, the Wintrust Arena. So Rahm scores another business to relocate from the suburbs to downtown. Now let's get that casino going, because it's going to take a couple of comp gin and tonics for me to get excited about the current tenants at the Wintrust Arena. Sky didn't make the playoffs last year, which if you're in the end, if you're a WNBA franchise, you got to make the playoffs. Otherwise, getting hot in here. All right, and finally tonight, the Spice Girls have announced they're getting back together. Yep, the famed pop group from the 90s say they're reuniting, but they will not record and they will not perform. What? Let me say that again. They will not record and they will not perform. So are they getting back together for the Spice Girl calendar? Oh, wait, please tell me they're not going all Kardashian and taking their clothes off on Instagram. Is that what they're doing here? I mean, that's a genre. I just hope it's a full reunion and we get Posh Spice, Scary Spice, and the rest, they let in the original Old Spice. Tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I want a new hip. Hold on. That was ridiculous. That was good, yeah. I tried. That's the carry out for February 2nd, 2018. In honor of the Spice Girls fake reunion, we're putting all spice on everything, which really is just colored salt. Coming up in the 7:30 segment, we're going to talk with Cam Davis and Josh Ellis about water. And a little bit later in the show, Mavis Staples. It's a big one tonight. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Jen DeSalvo in for Rob Martyr. What do you usually do on a Friday night, Jen? What's your Friday night plans? Tell us who are always here on Friday nights what's actually going on.
Oh, gosh.
You stay home? Do you go out? What do you do?
I go to bed very early because sometimes I also do morning television news. And so I get up at like 2 or 3 in the morning. Oof. Yeah, so 7 p.m. on Fridays.
Is that usually really?
By bedtime, yeah. Or I get up on Saturday mornings and go for like a really long run.
How do you do that? How do you get up that early? Or how do you go to bed that early? Do you tricked yourself? And are there any ways that you do that to like figure out how to go to bed at 7 o'clock?
Well, I don't think I've gone out in like 6 years. So, I mean, it's become fairly easy when you don't have much of a social life. I am married, so that also helps.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
That's part of the course for the married among us.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, waking up at 2, 3 in the morning, by the time 6 p.m. rolls around, you're like, all right, it's bed. It's bedtime.
When you don't have the shift, when you don't have to go to work on the weekend like that, do you find yourself, like, around 7, 7:30 being like, oh, gosh, it's getting late.
Yep. Still do the same thing, and then I'll wake up at 4:30. And go work out. So sleeping in is 4:30 a.m. Yeah,
I admire that. I always want to know how because we're the opposite.
Pete
and I, we end up going to bed so late after the show. But yeah, to get yourself up that early and have to go to bed early, that's a skill.
Yeah, tomorrow will be interesting for me. I guess you just pointed that out.
So are you on tomorrow morning too?
I'm not. Oh, I'm so not. Luckily,
you'll still get up early and go run.
Yeah, I woke up at 4:30 this morning. So you know. By the time midnight rolls around, it'll be interesting, guys.
Thank you, Jen. It's the download here, 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we're going to reload this week's news. Randy Bellisomo and Craig Newman will be in studio. What's the biggest stories, the winners, the losers, the overreported, the underreported? Which story took you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will be remembered 5, 10, 15, 20, 500 years? Right? I say it's going to be the story that the meteorite came down and their scientists are looking at it. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of like a bad Star Trek where something's going to crawl out of that thing. And that's going to, in 500 years, it'll be like, that's when the worm came out of the meteorite and destroyed civilization. That's my guess. That's what's coming up at the 8 o'clock hour. We're starting a three-part series of conversations starting tonight. It's called Air, Land, and Water. And we're partnering with our friends at the Metropolitan Planning Council to look at these three natural resources and explore the current landscape and the challenges we face in this region. Tonight, yeah, let's start with water. Pretty timely to talk about water as the international story surrounding Cape Town shortage gets more and more urgent. The South African city is on course to run out of fresh water by April. This April. Add that to the fact in the U.S. news that California is once again looking at drought conditions. It's a perfect time to talk about our region's relationship with the most precious of resources. I mean, we've talked about Lake Michigan, the goal of keeping contaminants out of the water in our local riverways, invasive species and waste, and of course what's being done at the EPA, both federal and local, to keep this a top priority in our area. Tonight, my pleasure to welcome Cameron Davis to the program. The water policy expert was appointed by the Obama administration as a top policy advisor for the EPA back in 2009. Before that, he was the president and CEO of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Cam, good to see you. It's been a long time.
It's been a while. Good to see you, Justin.
Welcome back.
And Josh, good to see you,
and
too.
And Josh Ellis returns to the program. He's a regular here on the Downland. He's a vice president at the Metropolitan Planning Council, works with several water-related programs there. Josh, good to see you, bud.
You too.
All right, so why don't we start with you, Josh. What is the air, land, and water? Why are you guys taking this on, and why use the resources, no pun intended, at the Metropolitan Planning Council to look into these issues?
Sure. So I think it's no secret across the federal landscape we're at a moment of change and uncertainty. And so Metropolitan Planning Council, which seeks to inform public discourse here in the Chicago region on a whole range of urban and regional development issues, is in itself kicking off a series of events, our lunchtime roundtable series, reflecting a year into the Trump administration how federal policy is affecting systems we rely on. So the first one of those is next Thursday, February 8th at noon,
which I will be
Justin is going to be our moderator, and Cam's one of our panelists. That will cover air, land, and water. We'll have a woman, Sandra Washington, who used to work for the National Park Service, talking about public lands, and a professor at the University of Chicago, Amir Gina, talking about air quality issues. And then later in the year, we'll have one that's more focused on housing, community development, and health. And then later in the year, one that's more focused on hard infrastructure, whether that's roads, bridges, pipes, pumps, that sort of thing.
We've heard a lot, Cam. Obviously, in the changes in the EPA under Scott Pruitt, but we've also just heard a lot about the rolling back of regulations.
Right.
And, you know, when I talk about California and drought conditions and you talk about what's happening in Cape Town, right away you go, okay, but Chicago has Lake Michigan and we have fresh water and we are going to survive when others, obviously more people are going to move to this area because of this lake. Should we be laid back and put our hands back and be like, we got this huge freshwater system, the Great Lakes. We don't really have to worry about anything.
No, not in this region. We can't be complacent ever be complacent. And when you take a look around the upper Midwest, you see places like Toledo that are struggling with people who have a tough time paying their water rates. Detroit, the same thing. Toledo, of course, had the shutdown in not too long ago, August 2014, because of toxic algae out in Lake Erie. And we even have in Door County, which a lot of us love to go to in the summer to, you know, get out of Chicago, up by that area, we have shallow well aquifers that are being contaminated by livestock manure. So, you know, even though we think about this region as water abundant, and it is, it's very water abundant, we have our share of challenges too, and they keep popping up. That's got to tell us something. We can't take it for granted.
You know, Cam, and I've talked to you numerous times about the health of Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes over the years,
right.
And I guess I asked the question from your time at the Alliance to now, I mean, being even in the, being involved with federal policy at the EPA in Washington, have the lakes gotten better?
I mean,
in the last 20 years?
I actually think that the lakes have gotten better with respect to toxics. The problem is that there are a bunch of other threats that are going on right now. One of the things that Josh and his group at the council, which does amazing work, has been working on is keeping Asian carp and other invasive species out of the Great Lakes. It's not just about pollutants and poison, you know, like Flint and drinking water. It's also about how organisms can get into the Great Lakes and then unravel the very delicate fabric of life that we have in this region. You know, it's amazing to me. You go to the Chesapeake, and the salmon out there are iconic. I mean, and the soft shell crab in the Pacific Northwest, the salmon are iconic. Here we've got things like whitefish and perch, things that I grew up fishing for, and that, you know, people's livelihoods in the past have been based on. These are important to us in this region. They help make up who we are. And so caring for these this really magnificent natural resource is critical.
Josh, I was going to bring you in just because I saw this week, it was the Illinois River had a toxic issue with some old toxic waste that seemed to be leaking.
Yeah.
We've had in the last year or two chromium leaks coming out of BP plants. And I mean, even though, as Cam said, pollutants aren't what they used to be, it's surprising to me in 2018 that you continue to see these issues, right?
Not like the good old days.
Right.
You still do. I mean, we had an oil spill in Bubbly Creek a few months ago, right? unclear where it came from, right? It wasn't reported on social media until likely a few days after it happened, at which point a lot of the evidence was gone. So a little unclear, but in a full-on oil spill. Oil on ducks getting removed with Dawn and paper towels like the Valdez,
wow.
Right? A couple miles
right
from where
here,
we
yeah.
sit right now, right? So we definitely still have issues, right? We've got leaks from industrial facilities on the lake down in Indiana that's leading to all sorts of lawsuits. We still have, you know, combined sewer overflows, although we're getting better in that regard. Sitting here a couple feet from the Chicago River, we just have litter blowing into the rivers constantly. And one of the challenges with that is, one, who's responsible if litter just blows into the river? And two, no matter how clean the water actually is, and we're getting pretty close to swimmable water in our rivers, if there's coffee cups and worse, just floating, no one's going to believe it. Right?
Right.
And so it's just this continual
yeah, right.
perception that no matter how clean the water is, it's not that clean because you can see a McDonald's wrapper and whatever.
Cam, I have a curious question just as someone who just observes the news, and when it comes to situations like we had this past year with chromium, a lot of times, and as you just mentioned, Josh, with the oil spill in Bubbly Creek, the public, it's not an immediate story, meaning it's not breaking news. We don't hear about it. It feels like the corporation or whoever's involved with it gets a little bit of time to figure it out before the public gets wind. Well, what's the EPA's role in that? I mean, is it the same thing? Is a big company like BP, are they not telling the EPA, or does EPA know when you guys are working on an investigation before the public finds out about it?
Yeah. No, the EPA knows about these things. It's required that those kinds of incidents be reported. The thing that we have to remember is that the states are on the front line. You know, the EPA plays a backup role. They're the ones who, you know, if the states aren't doing the job, the EPA is supposed to step up and do that. My concern is, and you'll hear more of this when we all get together on Thursday, is, you know, what happens when that enforcement and that compliance safety net seems to be gone, or it's weaker than it used to be because of politics? We have to step in as the public and make sure that we're continuing to demand that clean water is vital to all of us.
You know, that's such a great thing to say, because when you think about the federal programs like the EPA or even with the national parks and the other places and people that are going to be involved in this discussion, they are considered to be safety net when states or cities or municipalities fail. Mm-hmm. And you've seen from this administration more of an approach or a policy approach to say, we don't have the money and resources for safety nets. Mm-hmm. We don't have this for this. So yeah. You know what? States and cities, you're on your own.
That's I have heard and seen that argument through 20, 30 years, Josh. Yeah. You probably have too. And I have come, and I, you know, I've seen it in all kinds of changes. I have come to the realization that it's not true. It is a matter of priorities. You know, we put our money in the places that are important to us. And time and time and time again, the public has said water, clean water, is important to us.
I mean, it's the
end
lifeblood.
Of story.
I mean, it is the end of. I don't understand how water is political.
Well, and here's the thing that I found working at the administration, where my job was to be in front of Congress, it was bipartisan.
Yeah.
You know, for as much as we read about the administration in Congress, we had Republicans and Democrats, you know, basically walking together on the Great Lakes. It's a bipartisan issue.
Yeah. I had the opportunity a few months ago. Senator Duckworth here, one of junior senator from Illinois, is has a leadership role for the Democrats on the Environment and Public Works Committee. And so I had the chance to go and testify in front of the Senate, which I'm sure Cam's done. It's an interesting experience, to say the least, when you bump into Rand Paul in the men's room and Elizabeth Warren in the elevator, and then you get to go testify in front of a bipartisan panel, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, so these folks that you hear about, Boozman, whatever. And to a person, what do we need to do in order to invest in our drinking water systems? What are the problems? Is it contamination of the lakes? Is it over pumping of groundwater? What are we doing wrong with pipes and pumps? Why do we see communities throughout the United States leaking 25% of their water, 30% of their water? You treat it, you pump it out of your treatment plant, and it just leaks out of the pipe on the way to.
So they're
somewhere,
asking those right? questions.
They're asking these questions and trying to figure out, regardless of party, right?
Hmm.
When it comes to the local level and the ability to invest, your point is well taken. The federal government used to for any infrastructure project, right? It's not unheard of for highways like the interstates, right? Nine federal dollars to one local dollar, right, or one state dollar, right? Which is a pretty great match rate, if you ask me, right? Probably unsustainable over the long term, and we don't do it anymore, right? So the funding priorities, the sort of funding principles document that's come out of the Trump administration recently, which is not inconsistent from past administrations, really, in this narrowing the amount of federal money that would be part of infrastructure projects, whether it's water, whether it's highways, whether it's anything else, down to saying that the max would be 20% of any project, right? And so that 80% has to be made up by the state or local units of government or potentially the private sector.
Right? Yeah, when you say 80% has to be made up by the private sector or municipalities,
or
you automatically realize that's not going to happen.
50 states in 50 very different financial straits and hundreds of municipalities in Illinois alone in very different financial situations, and you see this in their ability to invest in the basics.
Let me do this. Josh Ellis is the Vice President of Metropolitan Planning Council, one of the vice presidents there, works with several water-related programs. Cameron Davis, former policy advisor at the EPA in the Obama administration, and we're talking about water in a new series we're putting on, Air, Land, and Water, which is in partnership with the Metropolitan Planning Council. Let's take a break, come back, we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Josh Ellis and Cam Davis. We're talking about water, really a three-part series I want to do with the Metropolitan Planning Council about air, land, and water. And we start with water because, you know, it's a big issue, especially with Cape Town, South Africa. And the same with California, again, with the droughts. It seems like you can't get ahead of that stuff. And we talked about pollutants in the Great Lakes, but let's talk about drinking water. I'm fascinated by the fact that we don't have it almost feels like we've seen the news where some of the collar suburbs and people are doing either what might be groundwater, it might be well water, it might be some sort of policy, but they're not necessarily pulling water from Lake Michigan. There's no organization here, and they find themselves charging a ton of money, and they don't have the resources to get the resources. How do we deal with that? How do we, let's start right there, Cam. How do you deal with the fact that each town does water differently?
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that I think is almost a universal, I won't say answer, but it's kind of a response to when water is running low is conservation, conservation, conservation. You can never conserve enough. And it's probably the easiest thing to do. It's probably the thing to do that saves you the most energy, which in a lot of cases for municipalities is one of the largest or the largest item on their utility bill and their expenses. So conserve is absolutely critical to do. And when it comes to aquifers, groundwater, things like that, yeah, we're really pumping hard from the ground. And you can't keep doing that. We can't keep sustaining that. One of the things that I think we need is a national water sustainability policy. We don't have that here
in
this country.
What do you mean we don't have
any kind of cohesive policy for how we are to be managing water. And the reason is because it's always been kind of the purview of the states. You leave it, the federal government doesn't want to get involved, it's because it's the states. But you look at these aquifers and they move across state boundaries or underneath state boundaries. They don't stay confined to one municipality or one state. And I think it's just, it's courting a lot of trouble for us to not be taking the long view and thinking ahead in terms of how we ought to be conserving and managing our water supplies.
It seems like, I mean, whether it be clean power or whether it be pollution or, I mean, you see it in so many other ways that even when it comes to our environment, regardless of administration, people like policies. They like plans. I mean, is it time for people to convene on a national water policy?
Yeah, I mean, so to the extent that we have national water policies, it's related to water quality, right? I mean, we have laws and rules requiring how clean the water is when it comes out of the tap in your sink. What we don't have are national sets of standards for the sort of supply-oriented management of that, right? What should the national standard be for the acceptable amount of leakage from a pipe system, right?
Right.
What do we have a target for per capita consumption and that we can use as an incentive to get perhaps some of the groundwater communities to rein things in a little bit or to encourage more conservation? So it's an ironic thing. In 2011, which is the last time we had a real drought year around here, water usage actually jumped. Right, it wasn't raining as much, and people thought they needed water to water their lawns, and so some of our North Shore suburbs, water consumption jumped during the drought by 400%. We had communities having to buy water from neighboring communities so that people could put it on their lawns, so that they would stay.
This goes to the issue, Cam, you mentioned about conservation. Yeah. We don't know what to do in this area with conservation. There's no way. If we ran into another drought and it got to California proportions, Illinois and all of the townships and municipalities and suburbs, we wouldn't even know what to do.
Your point about Cape Town coming close to running out of water here in about 2.5 months. In 2011, we had reservoirs in the southern part of Illinois that had 3 months left on their clock. And then it started to rain. And because it started to rain, we haven't actually addressed the systemic issues that were leading to that drawdown. We had conflicts in court between hydroelectric dam operators and farmers trying to figure out who got the last amount of water in the river to do what they needed to do. So we certainly have water conflict in this state, and I'm not sure that once it starts raining that we actually solve those issues.
You guys, sorry, we could talk about this. Yeah, thanks for bumming me out.
I'm thirsty.
Yeah. Cam, you're running for Water Reclamation Commissioner. When did this happen?
Yeah.
You're not even on the ballot.
I know. There was a vacancy that opened up because of a very nice guy. Tim Bradford passed away, unfortunately, and untimely. And the only way to get on the ballot is a write-in. So I'm running as a write-in for the Water Reclamation District. And early voting starts March 5th, goes into the primary on March 20th.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. I would like to see who writes
it.
Well,
they say it can't be done, and I disagree. We live in an era of social media, and people are fired up. I think people can write a person's name into a ballot. Call me optimistic, but I don't think it's too heavy of a lift for our water.
And on Thursday, there's going to be a panel discussion about air, land, and water.
February 8th, noon, at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Go to metroplanning.org. Go to the events page. You'll see all the information to sign up. Cam will be back for that, talking about water issues, and we'll have folks talking about the National Park Service and then air quality issues as part of a series.
Josh Ellis from the Metropolitan Planning Council. Cam Davis, a longtime water policy expert, as well as a former Obama administration policy advisor at the EPA. Guys, thanks for coming in. Thanks for doing
this. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks very much, Justin.
A lot of fun.
Thanks, Jen. It's Download Here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it is time to reload this week's news. Lots to talk about. The biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. What story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story from this week's going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 5,500 years? I still have bets on the meteorite story. They found a little piece of the meteorite in Michigan, and they're investigating, they're exploring. I just feel like something's going to come out of that ruins our society.
They're trying to tell us it's very mundane makeup.
That's what they want you to believe, Craig. That's what they want you to believe. In studio tonight, Craig Newman. He's a regular here on the Download. He covers, he's always on the Reload, and he's a freelance newsman, we'd say, a veteran newsman, journalist, Sun-Times, Cranes, other places. Good to see you, bud. Thanks
good
for being
seeing
here.
Freelance.
Randy Bellisomo, our brethren over at TV side. She is a reporter on WGN-TV. Randy, great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Justin.
All right, so let's get to it. I guess biggest story of the week. We start. There wasn't a lot of debate in our circles today. It has to be the memo. What do you think of what happened today and what happened in the subsequent days leading up to this?
What a confusing jumble of nonsense. Everybody was drawing comparisons to the Al Capone vault, and there really are a lot of similarities. It seems to be kind of a nothing burger, but now Nunez is promising more.
See, I want to hear this because I was telling Pete earlier, I'm like, this has been, indictment of my Twitter feed. In the way that, you know, we talk about bubbles that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the people that I follow, friends, but also news, everyone, same thing, Craig, nonstop, like nothing burger, this a waste, all this retweets. And I'm like, there has to be another side to this and the side that I'm not privy to. Randy, why did you say really?
I think the side, so yesterday I was covering this, it WGN, and we were looking for Democratic input. And Mike Quigley was on CNN the night before, who's saying, it's like a high school junior who stays up all night to do a book report, and he hadn't read the book, and he's had two Red Bulls under his belt. He was dismissing it as it shouldn't go out. And then reading it today, I didn't get the high school book report since, based on my high school book reports, based on, I hadn't read the book at all. So I felt like that effort to tamp it down so much made me want to read it more.
Well,
and then I'm thinking, like, I wanted to bring up the issue of making things public. It seemed like the Republicans in this instance are taking a side that has long been championed by the most progressive of all of
transparency,
you know, people looking for access, transparency. And Democrats are on the side of what was long the conservative position. So I think that making things public has long been the liberal viewpoint.
I was watching, I can't remember, Pete told me the name of the guy, just caught it on CNN. I think it was Wolf Blitzer talking about it. But they made the point about this that I thought held most in my heart was this concept of, listen, there are a lot of things that go into a FISA warrant or to get a warrant to tap anything. I mean, you have to do hundreds of pages, and that they take it very seriously there. And when they say that a memo, a three-page memo, is out of context, that's what they're talking about. They're saying that there are a lot of different things in here that they can't tell you about, that that are serious things they have to do to get this warrant, and that it's a little belittling or possibly dangerous to just say, oh, yep, they tricked the FISA judge. Because it really doesn't work that way.
Yeah, especially for a U.S. citizen. You know, there are innumerable hoops, some of which, you know, we only have the vaguest of notions about. I'm with Randy on this, that for years people have been trumpeting clarity in terms of information coming out of the government. That's not what this is, though. It's this very small, truncated, highly partisan in many ways piece of information. You know, you've got Democrats on the committee arguing that their version of the memo should be released. Paul Ryan saying, well, maybe in time, we got to look at it first. The FBI is screaming about it. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. You've got the intelligence community that's both mum but also somewhat unhappy about it. And there's just not enough fact behind it to really warrant taking it seriously yet. And it contradicts itself in some ways as well in terms of timing, you know, what the vaunted Steele dossier really means to the investigation, what the Papadopoulos angle is to it, when investigation started into one guy and when they launched into the next guy. You know, Carter Page is a declared foreign agent. And he's been on the FBI and Fed's radar for 4 years now, 5 years now, I think since 2003 anyway.
I know nothing about the FISA warrant process and the FISA court and everything involved. The memo makes it seem that it's easily trickable and that they are kind of out to lunch.
Right.
And you can see how a FISA court and what I was hearing today and reading about is that is not the right way to portray that court. That court is a very serious entity.
The Republican-owned Congress voted to re-up the FISA rule, you know, to allow FISA tapping of, in particular, U.S. citizens to occur when you go through the FISA court process. So it's kind of a mystifying argument that's being made around something that they just voted to maintain.
And this story is really complex, and I do not think I covered the story. I was at work for 11 hours yesterday, and I still don't feel like I understand it all, so I don't know about the average American news consumer. But here's the thing, like, to play the, you know, this fairly, if this were a GOP Koch brothers PAC who put the surveillance on a Hillary Clinton aide, the people on your Facebook page in the bubble would be up in arms.
Right.
So I think that this is fair. This is an issue. I don't know if it's as big a bombshell as everybody thought it would be, but hello, there's playing politics and law enforcement. That's a problem.
Yeah, and I will say one of the things that really hurts this has been the blow up to or the lead up to it, meaning everybody talking on both sides, as you mentioned, but even the Republicans and in some ways the media or conservative media talking that this is going to blow the lid off. This is going to be huge. And it really is something if you are a news consumer. And myself, I consider myself, when I saw the stuff, I'm like, I've already read about that. Mm-hmm. I've already read about that. I've already read about that. I've already read about that. This doesn't seem to be blowing the lid off anything. This essentially is what the columnists have been writing about for the last couple months.
And not just the so-called liberal media, the New York Times, the Washington Post. The Wall Street Journal has been doing some fantastic reporting on this leading up to it. And they've had a lot of details. I think they just had a report yesterday, maybe the day before, that put forth a lot of the information that we saw in here, but with a lot more detail behind it, a lot more reporting. Yeah, I mean, there's been so much buildup about this. You know, it's like the blockbuster that fizzles. It's kind of hard to fault the news cycle in that respect. But then again, you know, I guess I'm a little bit jaded and expecting something like this to come out on a Friday and be important. And the Friday, the week of the State of the Union, you know, you're completely stealing the thunder of your leader of your party.
But was there thunder?
Well, no. We're going to get to that coming up. It's hard to believe that the State of the Union was this week as well as we reload this week's news. What happens next? I mean, there has been so much talk, especially when you from columns and articles kind of looking down the road. If the president wants to fire some of the top heads of the FBI or the Department of Justice, does this memo give him the opportunity to do so? And could that mean in a way that it could be spark the end of the Robert Mueller investigation and firing Robert Mueller? I mean, there's a lot. It seemed like that was what was set up. But this sort of being a dud, does it hurt that theory? Does it hurt the idea that the president could go ahead and do these things?
I mean, with this president, I don't know. He's not going to hold to, you know, any norms or standards. He sails his own ship. So, yeah, I don't know.
But what I don't understand is why Christopher Wray's name has been, you know, circulating as he's in trouble, where he wasn't leading the FBI at the time of the alleged wrongdoing.
And he was
so I don't understand, other than
Trump,
that
right.
He disagreed with the person who appointed him. Is that cause for him to be axed? I don't understand the connection there. Maybe.
Well, I think it gets back to the loyalty mm-hmm. thing that keeps coming up with Trump and demands for various, you know, government officials to remain loyal to the president as opposed to the Constitution or their oath.
Yeah. Let's go to 312-981-7200. Let's bring in Jamie. Jamie, what's your thought on this story?
Well, I think you guys are kind of missing a very important point here. During an election, we have an investigation of one of the candidates, and you better have very good evidence that there's some wrongdoing there, and I don't see that there's enough that there should have been anything to investigate it.
Okay, that's a good question.
Because basically what you're looking at, if you do this, then it becomes more of a politically motivated situation. So there better be something there, and it better be definite.
Can we be specific?
And I don't see it.
Yeah,
it was an investigation into an aide to a candidate who the candidate dismisses.
Why were they investigating him?
That's a fair question, but I want to say that there wasn't an investigation into the candidate himself.
What was there to investigate the aide?
Well, he's been on the FBI's radar and the Fed's radar for a couple of years now because of his connections in Russia, because of contacts he's had with Russian officials, various academics.
There was even a story that the FBI came to him and said, "Listen, we think you might be you might actually be compromised at some mm-hmm. point." So yeah,
he had spent time in the Kremlin. I think I've read that he has spent extensive time in the Kremlin.
Thanks, Jamie, for the call. The question, I mean, I wonder if the American people could come together on the idea that if there is this thought that is coming through intelligence that some people who are working for a candidate, maybe not the candidate, you're right, not Donald Trump, but people who work, Paul Manafort comes to mind, Carter mm-hmm. Page comes to mind, that have had ties with foreign agents. It is, I think, appropriate to investigate whether or not they are being corrupted. Now, how you do that is what the memo's about, meaning did they do it the right way? Did they withhold information by trying to get the warrant? Did the FBI use politics and partisan politics, which I think is kind of ironic's not the right word, but there was so much made on the liberals or the Democrat side that Obama should have done more. Mm. You know, there was so much, you know, as a, while this was happening, that he should do something and he stayed out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that now it's about how partisan and they were,
what he did,
the White House was for, you know, Hillary Clinton, even though this was the justice.
I think it's important to remember, too, that, that Trump didn't really have access to what you would call the A-team of foreign policy experts coming out of the conventions. He was anathema within the party. They were kind of scrambling, trying to figure out how to back him, who to back.
That's right. There was thoughts about maybe replacing him at the convention. You're absolutely right.
Sure. Yeah. And so then you end up with a Carter Page. And, you know, you're not going to get the top name foreign diplomats. And he severely downplays the idea of diplomacy.
That's a great point.
You know, he was going pretty hard at the intelligence community. He was pretty limited in his choice of people he could listen to.
You're right. He ran as an outsider. And a lot of those guys, because I remember we were on the show with Touche, with Roebling and Lundy. And Roebling, the Republican, saying, Paul Manafort, I don't know if you're running as an outside campaign, why you'd have that guy. Mm-hmm. He's got such dirty laundry all over his stuff.
And very he mentioned shiny Russia. Suits, yeah, lots of right. them.
Craig Newman, Randy Delasoma in studio. We are reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll start with the winners and losers. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Lots of people texting in about the memo today, and we'll Mary has the best quote. Justin and guests, am I the only one to look up the word dossier? Can't stop thinking about it.
That word they keep using, it just makes it seem fun.
269 says, if the FBI was biased against the Trump administration, you can bet it wasn't political, but rather biased against anyone who would conspire with the Russians. Which is that's a very interesting point. The idea that, could you say that maybe there was bias because they felt that this candidacy, or not candidacy, but this campaign was conspiring?
I suppose, but I think there's better, more efficient ways to torpedo a campaign than this roundabout. Let him get elected, start pulling all these cast of characters in. I mean, you think about the leaks that came out of the New York field office around the Clinton campaign, you know, in the summer and coming out of the conventions again and leading up to the general election. That's, you know, pretty devastating stuff that built up over emails that may or may not have been smoking guns. It just seems like there'd be a better way if you're really interested in torpedoing.
630 says, I truly believe media is such a homogenous bubble that they can't see the bias here. Imagine Bush using Russian agents and RNC-funded Soaker to obtain wiretaps on Obama.
630, that's what I said.
Yeah, I'd be outraged, yeah. That's what they say.
Well, I said what you said that I didn't say. So I'm making the same argument WGN Radio. Right. So
this conversation is like the memo in microcosm. Right, I said, you said this.
But you're right. Like, hello,
but you're right about transparency. It used to be a Democrat thing, and now it's.
I said, could you imagine if somebody did the same thing to Hillary Clinton aide? Oh, the world would be outraged. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm with you.
All right, let's move on to winners and losers. And I would definitely want to talk about Illinois politics this week. It's amazing to me that we have been in a position where the state of the state was this week, and Jeannie Ives versus Bruce Rauner at the Chicago Tribune editorial board was this week as well. That seems like it was a month ago. But Jeannie Ives, on your list as winners, we'll start there. She had a strong showing. I mean, the headlines alone were like Drubs or Beats.
And Rauner had very little comeback. You know, the key line when Jeannie Ives said, and he even lied to the cardinal about the taxpayer funding for abortion and Medicaid, and he just said, that's outrageous. I mean, there was nothing. She just seemed to destroy him with every answer, and then after that, she got $500,000 from an ex-Rauner supporter. Right. And so things were really, really going her way. But then this afternoon, or late yesterday, this ad became airable, visible. It's not being aired in Chicago, but I'm going to let you guys talk about
the ad. Okay, so this is an ad that came out this afternoon that is an attack ad on Rauner. that uses caricatures, liberal caricatures, saying, thank you, Rauner, for letting me protest or sanctuary states. Thank you, Rauner, for letting me use the girls' bathroom.
A hairy man dressed up as a dress.
I mean, it's a very offensive commercial. There's a thank you, Obama, for letting me thank you, Rauner, for letting me have an abortion. Like, the woman with a pink hat on, like, who was marching.
Thanks for paying for all my abortions.
It's startling how offensive and caricatured it is.
I don't know if there's a stereotype generator that you can use to make political ads, but she clearly found it and ran this ad through several times. I was gobsmacked on the way over. I was on the train watching this thing. I think my jaw was actually on the floor. I don't know how you produce an ad like that in this day and age, but I know it'll play well with some of the quote-unquote base.
I mean, she's playing to a conservative base, and these are all liberal caricatures that in the cartoon. I love that Freudian slip. It's very, very cartoonish.
But actually, it does have a little bit of a cartoon
feel. In the ad, it essentially is thanking Rauner for and all these liberals thanking Rauner for helping them out. So, I mean, it does play to her conservative base,
and that is her audience. Remember, she entered this race after the abortion decision by the governor, going against what everybody assumed that he was backing with the cardinal, and he was not running on social issues. He didn't care about social issues, and everybody said, well, he did it because of his wife, and that's when she entered the race. And there are a lot of people that care about that issue and care about the fact that it was just such a stunning reversal. What mm-hmm. he did and what he said are just two different things, and so that's what she's going after. But I think I don't think we'll see it in this area, but yeah. I was shocked the depictions of what she put
I think it's pretty clearly an anti-Rauner ad, obviously, but it's an anti-Chicago ad.
Yeah.
It's going to the rest of the state and saying, it's them. It's the teachers who are of a different race. It's the transgender people. It's the people who are soaking off the public fountain. It's something.
I thought we would hear from transgender advocacy groups at least by this time.
I mean, you probably still. This just came out today, but it is stunningly, if off color, if not offensive. But you're right. Absolutely playing towards us versus them, and the idea that if you live in Chicago, you're a liberal. immoral liberal who wants to use other people's bathrooms or whatever they're going for.
And that had to have been produced before Monday, because I would say after Monday and after the infusion of cash, it seemed like she had all this momentum, and that was already sitting in her office waiting to be released. She didn't have to do that.
And to be fair, it was released by Rich Miller in Capital Facts, so it hasn't yet hit. And Dan Proft even came out and said, we're not sure, I'm not sure we're going to air it.
Although I would say the production values aren't the highest. It's possible that Julian 500K just went straight into the meme right. generator.
Well, it's Jeannie Eyes does stay on the winner list for her trouncing of the governor. Now, the governor has said, that's it. We're not going to do any more debates. We're not talking again. This is it. I'm not giving any more space to breathe.
Now, is she a winner, or is he just such a big loser at this point that she elevates a status or two
possible.
By default?
I mean, he had and it's a tough week for him, and we'll get to that. I mean, the state of the state, he gets the opportunity with the state of the state and the budget address to have the pulpit. I mean, to be up behind the podium and get everybody's attention. So that is a plus for the governor going into a contested primary. Craig Newman, Randy Bellisomo in studio. We're reloading this week's news. We come back, we'll stick with the winners and then get into losers. That's the best part. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Yeah. It's a download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Randy Bellisomo, Craig Newman in studio. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We are in the winners and losers. So another winner, and if we stay in the winner category before we get to the losers, which everybody loves, let's talk about Daniel Biss, the state senator who is running for governor on the Democratic side. The first real polling came out, and surprise, surprise, he was number two. Well, that's surprising. Everyone thought it was a race between Chris Kennedy and J.B. Pritzker, but Daniel Biss moves into the second spot. Did that surprise you, Craig?
I think it was a pretty big surprise. I mean, you know, he had a little momentum. He's got a little bit of name recognition around the city. But, you know, I think Pritzker going after him with these attack ads is really going to elevate him a little bit. And I think it started to do that. They're having to pay attention to him. Kennedy just can't get any traction. And, you know, sort of by default, Biss is rising up a little bit. And I think people are wary about billionaires.
And last week the news was that Senator Biss had had raised more money than Kennedy in January. So, I mean, you start to see he's also timed his ads in a different way that they're starting to hit now, where Kennedy inexplicably ran him around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot about campaign strategy and what goes into it.
Says Christmas like some good advertising for, you know, campaigns.
The big story, though, from the poll, it's great for Daniel and the fact that he's number two in this poll, is a wide margin. And they have the Pritzker name recognition of something 30-some-odd points or something. I mean, it's not a close race. It just was more close. It was closer between second and third than it is to the front runner.
Yeah, but you could make the argument. I mean, does Biss really think he can win the Democratic nomination? I don't know. Maybe he does. I guess you have to go into these campaigns thinking you can win. Or is this about something bigger? You know, is this setting up a run for a national office? Is this setting up a run for a broader office in a couple of years down the road?
Like what?
I don't know.
Congress, yeah. Congress, maybe. Statewide office, like, I don't know, replace Jesse White. Then.
Yeah, well, it's got to happen one day.
One of these days, right? But, you know, because it's funny because Biss had thought to be interested in the comptroller and he was raising money for that, and then he backed off of that, and then or maybe it was treasurer, one of the two, but then ended up running for governor, just going for it. So you may be right on that. Randy, are you sick of the election yet?
Not yet.
Or is it just heating up?
Just like the things that happen that are so out of the blue, you know, where Kennedy can't think of a nice thing to say about J.B. Pritzker, and then Pritzker puts out a website about all the bad things he can say about Dan Biss. The surprises are numerous enough that keep me interested, yeah. Especially the ad on the Republican side. So I will be, but I'm not there yet. I think I keep thinking that the Kennedy brand operation is strong enough somewhere to finally get some traction. Yeah. And I keep thinking it's going to happen, but I don't know if you guys agree with me.
It might be the wrong Kennedy.
Yeah.
Well, I have in the loser category as well, and I put Ives in the category too, just because it's about campaign ads. I thought that Pritzker's ad as well this week, in which it was released that he just had footage of Jeannie Ives beating up on Bruce Rauner in the Tribune editorial board, you know, where she was beating him and he was laughing, and it was like it was a negative ad. And at the end, you think it's for Ives because it was just showed her in a good light, and it says Pritzker for governor. You're like, what does that have to do with you? I mean, that again, like, why are you in there? Just like Rauner the week before was in there with the Blagojevich tapes on Pritzker. I'm like, just, guys, stick to your own primary. Get to the general stuff coming up.
Which I don't know if I can take several months of Rod Blagojevich tapes, to be honest with you. I mean, can we just be done with that at some point?
Years.
Yeah. You've got, Randy, you've got winners outside of politics. South Shore residents. Why?
Right. Because, well, for about 5 years now, the South Shore neighborhood has been a food desert on 71st since the Dominicks left in 2013. And Alderman Leslie Harrison has been working and working and working to get the mayor to come through with his promise to end or reduce the number of food deserts in the city. And remember, he put 10 biggest crises that were facing the city when he first ran for mayor years ago. Food deserts was number one.
And he's a big deal about the Whole Foods that moved in Inglewood.
Right, which wasn't technically a food desert because there was an Aldi really nearby. And all that time when Whole Foods was going in, Leslie Harrison was saying, we have nothing in South Shore. And so finally, Shop and Save just signed a letter of intent to go into the Jeffrey Plaza on 71st Street. And that was filling a desperate need. And, you know, I was thinking back about all the coverage of food deserts, and we don't hear about it a lot anymore. Right. frankly, I think it's because the Emanuel administration has not made as much progress as it said that it would on the issue, and they even changed the definition of food desert or in residents in the population where food deserts could be applicable to only low-income residents. So they reconfigured
what it means,
what it meant, yeah. So their statistics and progress would go up, and it is a real unfinished business on the part of the mayor's administration. But this Shop and Save was a great step for the people in South Shore because that neighborhood needs it, and there's been a lot of crime. I've covered crime on that stretch of 71st that has happened in the years since Dominic's
and
closed.
Could you imagine, I mean, for a lot of our listeners who are listening right now, living in a community where there just wasn't a grocery store.
Right.
Where the only place you could get any sort of goods that you could survive on was the gas station or the 7-Eleven. For a lot of our listeners who live in communities in the western suburbs, northern suburbs, northwest suburbs, south suburbs.
It's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine. All right, so keeping on winners, I just put this on the winners, fact-checking websites that made it because of the State of the Union. There was a story that one of the fact-checking websites, I forgot which one, actually was down the night of the State of the Union because so many people wanted to check and see what was true and what wasn't from the president's speech.
Interesting.
So that's a winner for the fact that we're being learned, if you will, that there are organizations that you can go to see if the politicians are speaking truth.
It's certainly a cottage industry cropping up, but I have trouble figuring out. I think there's plenty of appetite for fact checking. I have trouble figuring out how many people are actually buying into the fact checking because nobody has standard definition for what facts are anymore.
Right. Although, oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
It's I don't know. It's a little bit of a
you're absolutely
a head
right because for the president to say it's the lowest unemployment of African American Hispanics, he's right. Or, that is a fact. He's right. Now the fact checking sites will say, well, it's been on a decline for the last 10 years, so it's a little disingenuous to say that it's the lowest because it was going there anyway. But he is right.
Or even more basic, that he had the highest rating ever for a State of the Union, which is, you know, easy to disprove, and yet people were still buying into that.
I love it. I love. I don't know what it is. There's something about this president, and I cannot wait for all the biographies on him for his time in office. That does he put that stuff out because he just loves how everyone just kind of goes rabid over these facts and figures and fiction and all that kind of stuff, because everyone gets so worked up over what he probably just kind of snickers as he tweets into that.
I just think he's a lifelong marketer, and you know, marketer's going to market.
Circus Barker, man, yeah.
Yeah, and you're always going to have to add a little bit of flair.
I think he gets a little thrill when it makes everybody go crazy. I mean, it's nice to have everybody, for a very short moment, to have everybody reacting to what you say. Why do we all go on the radio?
Yeah, there you go. Other winners, the Chicago Bulls, I guess, would be in the winner category with the trade of Nikola Mirotic. Nikola Mirotic, it didn't seem like he was going to be able to be tradable. He turned it on. They were able to get rid of him, and they got something in return. Maybe a first-round pick and Omer Asik. I mean, what do you think, Craig?
Any movement for the Bulls these days, I mean, it's going to be sad that there's no more Fight Club. That might be the most watchable thing about them as the season kind of winds down. But, you know, it's what, a first-round pick, and I guess Omer Asik is back, great. I mean, you know, but what are they going to be able to do with it?
If they are a team that is in rebuild, that even might even be a purposeful tank, if you want to go there. Acquiring first-round picks for bench players, not bad. Top 10. It could be a top 10 pick.
It could very well be. Do you buy into this management regime to make good use of a first-round pick?
Yeah, that's a different issue, different story. You're absolutely right. They have not shown. I mean, all you have to do is look at Doug McDermott and Denzel Valentine, and down the line they've had first round picks and they have not done well with them. You're right, they got lucky on Derrick Rose. That was actual magic
for a little bit.
Alright, so let's turn to the losers. We'll do this, we'll take a quick break, we'll come back and we'll get to the losers because we have a lot to get to tonight, a lot of diverse stuff. Randy Bellisomo, Craig Newman in studio. We're reloading the news, stay with us. Yeah, I have the groundhog on my over-reported But that, which one? Which one?
There's a million.
Yeah, there's
of them.
A million of them.
I saw a graphic from Pennsylvania. There's got to be at least a half a dozen just in that state now.
I just feel like that's every year I could say overreported. I've lost interest in the tradition that is getting a groundhog to.
I will watch the movie though.
Yeah, the movie's great.
I wonder if a groundhog makes a good pet.
Yeah, that's a good
no,
question.
They're nasty.
Are they nasty?
Feral rodents.
Really. They're
was it,
so
wasn't
cute.
Wasn't it De Blasio that was trying to pick it up and it bit his hand and he dropped it and it died like 3 days later?
Oh. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
When groundhog political stunts go awry, yeah. You can find that on the internet. Greg Newman, Randy Bellisomo in studio are reloading this week's news. Let's get to the losers. This is what everybody loves. Let's start. I really, really like your collection, Randy, especially when we talk about the Miglin family.
Mm.
You know, we'll get into some more serious stuff, but that the Miglin family,
yeah, it was serious.
You know what, it is serious. And we're talking about the show on FX, which is about the Versace story, and it's getting a lot of great buzz for the show. But you're right, Chicago plays a big role, and it was about the Miglin family, and they went through the ringer, and here they are on TV being fictionalized. You're right, not great to have your name come back again.
No, and especially given that, and I was not in Chicago. I was growing up, but this is national news then, and I remember watching this primarily because my mother wore Miglin makeup, and so this was just it's like a death in the family. Marilyn's husband was murdered, and all the way, and we were in Memphis, Tennessee. But I'll tell you that reading from my journalist perspective now, how the newspapers in Chicago seem to have treated the Miglin family at the time of the murder, that there were many speculations of what was going on between Cunanan and Lee Miglin or Marilyn and Lee Miglin's son, Duke, that it doesn't seem like anybody came out and said it. And I was trying to think, if that had happened in today's world, would we give any Chicago icon or leading figure the same sort of respect? I don't think we would. I don't think anybody's that loved or that we're that respectable. And so how it was treated then, and then all these years later, it being put on the screen in a very popular show, FX, which I think they're doing a great job in terms of telling a story, but just putting myself in the Miglin family's shoes and seeing that. And then what they did, if you're not watching the show, is that they created a lot of the dialogue between gay lovers that they assume happened that night prior to the killing between Andrew Cunanan and Lee Miglin, and him kneeling down, Lee Miglin kneeling down before an altar in his house and say, "I just can't, I can't help me." And then he turns to Cunanan turns into this heated affair. And I just know that that has to be, I even felt bad sending it to you for my loser pick, because I know that it has to make them feel so horrible watching this.
Yeah, it's hard when you're doing these reenactment type shows that really deal with real people. That's got to be tough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
were you covering news at the time?
I think I was in Boston, so I didn't pay much attention to the story, to be honest.
Well, okay, that's a great one, though. That's one that's a little bit off, because, you know, when we start talking about, let's take it back to some of the things that happened this week that we've already kind of touched on. I thought that the State of the Union, I thought Dreamers kind of were in the loser category, just for the all Dreamers matter approach of President Trump to essentially co-opt
We all have
that.
Dreams, Justin.
We all have dreams. But to co-opt that word or that phrase and to put it on all Americans.
That was good PR.
It was good PR for them, but puts the Dreamers, the DACA recipients, in the loser category.
Well, yeah, and I guess there was some reporting around him not wanting Democratic leaders to use the phrase Dreamers leading up to the State of the Union, because it makes them too approachable and, you know, too sympathetic, and nobody knows what a DACA is.
Right. Well, there you go. The others, I thought there was some other stuff, too. When we get into media, I think there were some stories, even today, the Chicago Sun-Times, making the announcement that Hedy Weiss, the longtime theater critic, is out. She has been terminated. The position has been eliminated. And then just tonight, Richard Roper reinstated after an another story this week of him. The New York Times did a big piece about inflated Twitter followers, and they used him as an example. The next day, the Sun Times comes out, and they didn't use the word suspension, but they said his stuff has been removed, and we're investigating. There's a lot that went into the media world this week.
Yeah, and the Reader named a new executive editor,
Mark Conkle.
Who's a winner, not a loser.
Pulitzer Prize winner. So, definitely.
Big winner.
You know what? I think we were talking in the break. This is kind of a loss for cultural criticism in a town that's kind of had it on the wane for a little while. We've got a booming culture scene here, but we don't have a lot of people talking about it in an educated manner too often. I mean, Chris Jones is excellent for the Trib, mm-hmm. and then it starts to become kind of a drop-off.
And if you think about New York is known for theater, number two city, I think, would anybody argue with us saying that Chicago is the second biggest theater destination in the country?
Yeah.
And our number two newspaper, or second newspaper, whatever you want to call it, as I sit in the Tribune Tower, is dropped its theater critic. I think it is tragic for arts criticism, because I think we are in the end of arts criticism. And I know that even for quote-unquote lower arts, I think in 2016 there are only 10 full-time film critics in the country, which is kind of shocking. So you have to think that theater is even lower than that. Yeah. What does this mean? What do people do? There are a number of blogs and websites who are doing this.
Chris Fusco, he came out in the feeder piece today saying, well, we're reimagining how we're going to cover arts and culture.
That mean?
Well, I don't know what it means, but my point being that Hedy Weiss, and we can bemoan the end of cultural criticism as we know it, but she also was a controversial figure.
She had her moments.
She had her. There were a huge theater contingency, alliances and associations that came out and wrote letters. Steppenwolf was a part of it.
They
were very vocal to say, "Hey, we don't really like Hedy Weiss as coming." They said they weren't. She wasn't allowed back in their theaters.
And I thought it was based on one column that she wrote.
Just from my circles in theater, the thought was that was the straw that broke the camel's back. She had a bad review
of
Steppenwolf show. But the point being that there had been bubbles up and bubbling up and bubbling up, and then there was a viral campaign to get every theater in Chicago to make her pay for a ticket. Mm-hmm. Now, and I agree with the idea of cultural criticism being, eliminated, and that's a big issue, and Hedy has had a long, outstanding career here Chicago. But it could also be the fact that, there has still been tension between the theater community and their number one critic.
But, right. I know that this is a controversial topic, but here's the thing. There are two people in Chicago who shine a light on cultural, on the theater arts in Chicago, Chris Jones and Hedy Weiss. And when you have a critic, and I understand where a lot of the controversy was from, but theaters are not always going to appreciate what critics say. And I think that she said some things that mm-hmm. probably crossed the line.
Sure.
But I do not like it. I don't like the premise, whereas the person who's being written about gets to determine if the person writing has a job. I think that that's a dangerous thing.
Although we don't know that that was the reason that she was let go today.
No.
From my time there, and it's been a few years at this point, I know that there was a groundswell of unhappiness with her from the theater community, but it never got serious enough that there was any sort of conversation either way.
Right.
That said, when I hear the, anodyne, we're going to rethink how we do cultural criticism, I hope that's true. I hope that there's a good idea in place. But that's, isn't that what is always said when something is lost like this? Of course, you're going to try and rethink it. But, they're in a little bit of a situation because she was a union employee, and that's a protected position. So how they do that might be.
So how they say it or how they terminate positions, things like that. And then Richard Roper back to tonight. So Richard Roper back in. So
with a brand new Twitter.
An amazing conversation about the ethics of buying Twitter followers, wherever you stand.
So why is that okay?
Well, that's what I mean. It was amazing. I saw thought pieces out of nowhere. I would have been the person who went, I don't care. I really don't care. Because you know what? If you pay close enough attention to the arts, to celebrity, to music, to movie, to filmmakers, They have inflated numbers everywhere they go. They have companies that do it for them. When you're out in LA and you're an actor and you want to get big, you hire a PR company,
But he is a journalist.
I guess he is a journalist, but he's also, to me, he's a celebrity. He's Ebert and Roper. I mean, there's a little bit more to me that he's a personality. He's a guy to put up on the masthead as opposed to a guy with his, you know, like doing objective journalism. Although, he's a columnist.
When I started reading the story, I thought, yeah, but doesn't everybody do that? But the more I thought about it, you know, you are misrepresenting what you are as a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a brand as much as he is anything. So when you go out and say, I've got 250,000 Twitter followers, do you?
I don't know.
In my role, in everybody's role in television news, we get a report every morning about social media traffic. And they rank the stations, they rank the personalities, and how much traffic do you generate, and what do you do that gets buzz? And if you had Richard Roper in that metric that all the stations pay for to determine how successful they are online and spreading their news, then that would be it's unfair. It's wrong. It's buying success.
Well, they reinstated him, so I don't know what the deal was of the investigation. But my point being that, you know, I don't know the situation. I can only do what I saw in the newspapers and things like that. But I'm telling you that this is Greg. It's a cottage industry. There is a lot of artists that will hire PR people to get more social media impact. This idea that Rich Roper's in his basement, you know, going, I'm going to click here for $29.99 or $59.99. This is going to make me famous. That's the wrong narrative. That's not accurate.
I was thinking along those same lines, and then I went back and read the New York Times story. And I think it does get a bit deeper than that because there is a big awareness factor. You know, if you're trying to sell an idea of something and you're selling it on a false pretense, whether you're a brand or a personality or whatever, it gets to be dirty and tricky a little bit.
All right, coming up, we got overreported, underreported, we got the rabbit hole, and which story is going to be remembered? Craig Newman, Randy Bellisomo, reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Thanks, Jen. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up here at 9:30, we're going to talk with Carrie Kennedy. She's going to join us to talk about her new exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. Carrie Kennedy is the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Foundation, of course, the daughter of Robert Kennedy. She will join us. We'll talk about that. And at 10 o'clock, Mavis Staples. How great is that? Randy's got
unbelievable.
Tickets. You got tickets for tomorrow night, huh?
I wouldn't miss her.
Yeah, so
I'm jealous of the tickets. I'm jealous you get to talk to Mavis Staples.
A lot of jealousy going around.
A lot.
It's Friday.
312-981-7200. Randy Bellisomo, reporter at WGN-TV. Craig Newman, who's a longtime freelance but also veteran journalist who worked at places like the Sun-Times and Cranes. We're reloading this week's news. Let's get to overreported and underreported. Our text, I'll let the text take the lead on this. Here we go. 847 overreported the damn peacock therapy animal on the plane story and Groundhog Day. That's from Sue. And there's been a couple today talking about the peacock story.
You can take the groundhog on the plane, though. I mean, you can take anything on a plane.
This is on my list. It's on all of our lists because it's just absurd. And it's one of these stories that everybody has to put in the kicker. Everyone has to talk about a peacock and how planes are saying you can't bring a peacock on.
It's a great video.
But at the same time, there is a story here.
There's a problem. Sure. Everybody is abusing the rules, and there are real service dogs out there who do real things for people with visual and hearing impairments. Understood, but you can bring. Remember the food allergy, and many flights we can't have a peanut on the plane, but you can bring a Shetland pony, and that is the truth. Because if you say that you rely on that pony, which is actually one of the approved animals, a miniature horse, that you can have this, and it's so you don't have to go through the hassle of putting it on under the plane, paying for a checked baggage. Here's the thing. I heard it described as Noah's Ark this morning. I think that's true in all the list of animals that people have been bringing on, and there's been like 150% increase in like the last year. 250,000 emotional support animals on Delta in the past year. And I'm allergic. And let's talk about my allergies. I'm allergic.
talk about overreported.
I'm allergic to I would be absolutely miserable if you brought any feline animal on the plane. But you can bring that on if it makes you feel less sad. But everybody else, I don't know.
But Brandy, the big issue here, and Greg, chime in. But the big issue is, and everyone knows someone who does this, is that it's a pretty. It's almost like medical marijuana in California. All you got to do is go in and go, I got anxiety.
Right.
And you can get a letter and you don't have to check your dog. And that's really what it's about. And they mentioned it because it got completely overhyped because of the peacock. But they mentioned Delta, and I think it was United too, that said, listen, we're having issues where the dog defecates, they bark.
Attacks.
They don't understand what they're doing because they're not actual support dogs.
Sure, sure.
They're just being, it's a scam to get on the plane with you.
I will say, though, I'm a little offended, Randy, that Shetland pony is my spirit animal. Oh, I will try and keep it off the plane next time.
Well, you know what? Other people don't. And it's, I think that it goes to the point. They just now, Delta had to expand the list today, that they've now banned animals with tusks or hooves.
Wait a minute.
Right? That they have
what kind of an animal?
To do this. So there is an abuse. And I think that what, who is not being vocal enough, are the real people. I mean, do you know the amount of work that goes into
years.
Training a dog to be a real service animal? And these other pets that bark and defecate and urinate all over the plane is a real just offensive to me.
I want to know what kind of an animal has a tusk that you can get onto a plane.
I'm going to read. Oh, right. I'm
well,
going to get there.
Pony
I've got this whole
a,
list.
No,
yeah.
not a toss, but they but, have
and wild boar.
Yeah.
Wild and hooves. And there's these places online where it can connect you to a quote-unquote mental health professional who will give you a list that you have quote-unquote anxiety so you can bring your reptile on Delta.
All right. All right.
What?
All right. No,
do you want to bring your pet
bring,
on the
no,
plane?
I don't want to bring my cat. My cat doesn't even come down for food.
Your cat doesn't care about your emotions.
I'm allergic to that.
It is not,
and you can ban peanuts, but I can't ban the cat.
There is no emotional support coming from Mr. Mittens. I'll tell you that right now.
Okay.
So, it'd be great to take him on the plane. He would do everything he can to get away from me.
Find him hiding in the engine.
700 animals a day just on Delta.
Wow. I don't think I've ever been on a flight where I've seen an animal.
I've never seen one.
You haven't seen dogs?
No.
Well, they're often covered up. That's the other thing. Like, let's take care of our animals. They're covered up in these cases. Sometimes you don't even know they're in that purse. You know, purse puppies?
The worst part is getting them in the overhead bin.
Ugh.
All right. The other overreported
stories
we had.
I'm emotional about it.
State of the Union, I thought was in the overreported. State of the State as well. You
always.
Just kind of get to the. These are the State of the Union, surprisingly, acting like, oh, well, this is such news. I'm like, then we have one of these every year, and it's always the same, regardless of party. Secondarily, I would say the Super Bowl. And Randy, you said in the break that you felt that this was actually a down year when it comes to overhyping the Super Bowl. But I, as a sports fan, the 2 week lead up to this game that is a game is too much. It's
I would feel
much.
Differently if I lived in the Northeast, but I feel like we're spared some of that.
Because we have terrible teams.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just so regional this year. I mean, it speaks to the disconnect of the rest of America.
Between two cities with terrible fan bases.
There you go.
You said it.
Yeah,
I did.
All right.
And I lived in Boston.
Well,
for a while.
We'll get back to the Super Bowl, but underreported. Let's see. What do we have for underreported? I thought that North Korea came up on the list, Randy. You also talked about the. I mean, that obviously dovetails into the Olympics.
The Olympics
which start
are next week,
and
we
next week.
Yeah, I just remember Olympics. You have How's lead up
possible?
For weeks and weeks and weeks, and this is the Olympic and one of the most. You know. Heightened security places, you know, ever that we've had in Olympics, and so other than the ones that we've skipped, so I think that we're not paying a lot of attention. Trump did meet with North Korean defectors today. I don't know if anybody knows that. I mean, because I thought it was underreported, and like only one other president has ever done that.
Yeah,
and there aren't that many of them. But
right,
it,
there
it,
aren't that many
it,
of them.
It comes a day after the candidate for the South Korean ambassadorship was withdrawn. And now more than ever, we need a South Korean ambassador. Our relationship with them is soured, but with the Olympics coming up, and it's. Definitely.
The other story that 847 brought in was one we talked about in the 7:30 hour tonight. The situation in Cape Town, South Africa, that by April 12th they're going to run out of
water.
Water,
yeah.
Oh.
And it is interesting because this is not the first time in human history this has happened. It's usually when you're in drought conditions, the rain comes, and then we didn't think about it. As Josh Ellis from the MPC, Metropolitan Planning Council, was in your chair, Craig, he said this was Illinois back in 2011 when we had drought conditions, and it was an extended drought. Down in the southern part of the state, we were down to 3 months left in some situation. And it rained, and we forgot about it.
Yeah.
And that happened in California. It rained all last year. So we're like, and here come the drought conditions again.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to be underreported. For whatever reason, human beings were just not rallying around the idea that on April 12th, a city of, what, millions of people. That's a huge city. Cape Town's going to be out of water.
Wouldn't think it would happen there.
Yeah, well, I think some of these things are hard for us to imagine because we live right next to a big lake, or we don't get droughts necessarily in the city.
I guess, man. I feel like nobody in California is paying attention to it either.
No. I think it's the number one global issue.
It's huge. I just don't get why there isn't. I mean, I think look at your feed today. Did you see anything on Cape Town and water in April 12th?
No.
Well, there's also a pretty big dearth of foreign reporting if it doesn't involve North Korea or if it doesn't involve a catastrophe, which this is, but it's just a slower building.
It just seems like you would
less on Africa.
It'd be really nice to have like a week without intrigue on Capitol Hill about investigations and partisan politics.
A day,
and maybe we all put our attention towards a major city of human beings that are going to be without water in a month.
We've quickly forgotten about the famine in Yemen, but you're right. We it's too hard for us to imagine.
You could throw out there Puerto Rico while you're at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting story this week as well on Puerto Rico, kind of underreported, that FEMA had said, we're done. Mission accomplished. And then the press was so bad, they're like, well, all right, we'll stay. Essentially, I just summed up the FEMA story there.
Thank goodness for media.
Yeah. Thank goodness for media. Randy Bellisomo, Craig Newman in studio. All right, we'll come back. And we'll do the rabbit hole stories, and then we will pick the stories which will be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from now. So
five
stay
days.
With us 5 days, right? Yeah. Cool. I think later in the show, Jen, we'll talk about whether or not we're going to watch that game.
Okay.
I'm deciding. I'm getting closer and closer to making a decision on that. Earlier in the week, I was like, I don't know, man. This might be the one I skip. I have no love for either of those teams. I don't like Justin Timberlake, and I don't like the commercial. I don't like commercials.
So well,
I'm such a non-American that un-American that I don't like commercials, but I don't like them.
If you're not going to watch it, hop on WGNradio.com and follow our live blog.
I haven't watched the NFL in years.
Really?
Yeah. I just can't. I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're getting to the end here. Reloading the news. Let's get down the rabbit hole. Now, all right, so why don't we start with you, Randy? You had the story from this week's New Yorker about the case of Jahi McMath. I don't know the story.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. It made headlines a few years ago, and a girl in California, in Oakland, she had surgery for sleep apnea, and something went wrong. It was a tonsillectomy, and something went wrong, terribly wrong, in the surgery. African-American family. Reason to be suspicious about what happened to her in the hospital, I think they felt, because it was very routine. And she was declared brain dead. And I think that it's the New Yorker has dedicated a few things this week to the changing definition of death. And people who know me know that I'm into end-of-life issues,
yes,
which I'm not going to talk about right now. But what I'll talk about her is that her family did not accept the diagnosis. And they said, well, we can't continue to keep her on life support if she is declared dead. Her family had her moved across the country to a different state, in New Jersey, which has a different definition of death. They don't have to accept brain death as death. And she has been kept alive on life support, well, kept blood circulating and heart beating on life support. They've since moved her into an apartment that her family has gone into bankruptcy. Interestingly enough, the New Yorker highlights how she has, even though she's been declared brain dead, she has shown biological signs of adolescence. She began menstruating, and she is developing other situations. And they said, if somebody's brain dead, how can this happen?
Wow.
Which the family says, well, of course, I told you she wasn't dead at all. And she does have some responses when a family asks, can you move your finger? And maybe 20 seconds later, she does. But we've also seen these videos, if you remember back to the case of Terry Schiavo.
Yeah.
And those videos, there was a big controversy at the time because they said, well, the family was altering those videos. but then the doctors have said this has actually happened. And so I just think it's a really interesting story about a family who's been through the ringer, and it's fascinating.
That's in the New Yorker.
What's
happening. This week's New Yorker. Mm-hmm. All right, check that out. Craig, you were back to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You feel like the rabbit hole is a Super Bowl.
Well, football in general. You know, there's a new, I think it's NBC Wall Street Journal poll out today that's showing that support for the NFL is declining, but also support for football in general. You know, we've got plenty of youth teams around here that are folding. Yeah. Schools can't field enough players.
And Durson Act that went through the, that's going to be introduced in Springfield, or was introduced in Springfield?
Yeah, the no hitting until, what, 12 or 13?
Which totally makes sense.
It does, but I understand the other side of the argument that then kids are starting to hit without learning how to hit. But, you know, I played football growing up. I used to be a big fan. I still see the sport's obviously popular. But, you know, we were talking a little bit about we haven't seen kind of the hoopla around the Super Bowl going on. And it could be because our team's terrible here. Could be because everybody hates the two teams that are in it. But there does seem to be a vibe. And, it, you know, there's the Colin Kaepernick stuff. There's the CTE issues. There's the fact that the league is just run by some not very nice people.
I mean, if the game is supposed to be escapism, and I understand the social issues that are being protested at the national anthem, but to be watching the State of the Union and have the president even make remarks about the National Football League. Yeah, you're right. It just makes you go, it makes you not like the, I hate to do this, but say you don't like the National Football League. And the problem is that might be the intention of the president doing so, but the point being,
he's a Patriots fan.
Yeah.
Well,
he's also a guy who didn't get an NFL team when he wanted to get into ownership. And
which has been under his saddle for a while. Yeah. And then you got the XFL maybe starting up again. But I just think there's something going on with the idea of football in this country. And it, you know, is it at a tipping point? I don't know. But there's some sort of vibe about it that
I've been saying this for years. Nobody listens to me, and when it happens, everyone's
I listen to you
go,
all the time.
Thanks, Craig. I appreciate that. Robots. The game would be if you made it robots, and you painted the New England thing on the robots, and then when one got hit really hard and its arm fell off, it's the people on the sideline with the soldering guns, and that's where we're like, it's almost like Pit. It's like cars, like NASCAR. Sure. NASCAR, same concept. And you're like, look at how great the New England robot fixers are.
You can combine video gaming with robotics.
And they go in there, and they get hits, and I think I would still react to a big hit. I love robot number 62.
You know, like, lasers and, I don't know, flame.
I don't care that they're human beings playing now.
Get Elon Musk's flamethrowers attached to them.
I'm onto something. So if there are investors out there, you know, obviously they're bringing the XFL back. I say robot FL. We could do that.
Absolutely.
All right. My rabbit hole story is a story that Bill Ruthart had today. I wanted to put it in underreported, but I also feel like it's rabbit hole. But it's about the mayor's neighborhood development fund. So essentially, get this, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but Mayor Emanuel's approach to zoning. We've seen in the last week or two big projects. Right behind the Trib Tower, there's going to be a skyscraper that goes the second tallest in the city. A new one out west as you go close to the United Center they want to make it 60 stories. There's nothing over 4 stories in that area. Now, back in the day, that was
another one
big,
in Fulton.
Yeah, back in the day, there was like, oh, that's just not, you know, there are rules on the books. What the mayor has done is said, if you want to break the code, if you want to break the zoning code, you have to pay a fine. Mm-hmm. And this would be, and that fine, that money will be used for other neighborhoods, a neighborhood fund to help with impoverished neighborhoods or neighborhoods that need help that don't have resources. Well, yeah, developers are like, I don't care about a fine.
Sure.
And so they are building, you see cranes everywhere, and they're breaking zoning codes everywhere. And the mayor, and today it was, I believe it was someone in the mayor's office, Reifman, who said that they've got more money than they know what to do with. And that's crazy. Like, it was something where I had to look at the story, but it was something where it was millions of dollars.
$6.9 million.
Yeah. They say Reifman expects another 14 projects to pay $50.1 million to the city in 2018.
Yeah, as it turns out, luxury taxes do not work.
They don't work, right. And he's going to have $100 million, and they said he's going to use it for election time.
It's
meaning that right
him.
Before the election, he's going to dole out grant after grant after grant to these communities where he wants people to vote for him.
500 grants in South and West Side communities.
Now, I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm glad that the grants are going there, but to ruin the aesthetic and the culture of certain neighborhoods to be able to have this money to
hand it out.
I don't know. There's something about it that seems somewhat suspect.
Well, and it's basically, well, not that TIFs are super heavily regulated, but it's an unregulated TIF. It's a slush fund that, you know, what's going to be done with it. Maybe there's going to be some beneficial actions towards election time. Hopefully so. But, you know, he can do whatever he wants with it. And the mayor of Chicago usually does whatever he wants.
Yeah, and I just, I remember that Mayor Daley had a lot of trouble with TIFs. I really do. I remember that being something, not even TIFs, but just zoning, mm-hmm. where he wouldn't, he'd turn a blind eye, if you will, and he'd let the alderman deal with it, and it gives a lot of corruption that came to the alderman. So I understand the idea of maybe centralizing it. But at the same time, I also felt that the mayor was very effective in saying, if you're trying to break a zoning code and it went through the mayor's office, he wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I remember there was the project on Fulton back in the day when it was all meatpacking over there, where they started to build a big thing there because they had paid or greased the wheels to make it happen. And when the story goes that the mayor drove through there and saw it and said, this is not that kind of zoning, shut it down. And that building stayed unvacated or half built for 10-15 years. Mm. But this concept of a fund on top, it's just going, I don't know if that's going to work, because I know, living in the West Loop myself, there are a lot of people starting to get angry about skyscrapers.
Block views.
Or just, and not even block views, just density.
Mm.
This idea that you're going to build a 60-story off of Fulton.
Right.
Have you been on Fulton? It's a one-way street. So how are you going to do that? So I think that's an interesting story that the mayor is got a huge fund, neighborhood fund, off of letting some of these zoning things lapse.
As long as we get some more condos. That's really important.
That's really important. All right, Craig, Randy, we're down to the last category here, which is, which story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week? Craig, what do you think? What do you got on your list?
Well, you stole my space story, so I'm going to go with Amazon. The pendulum seems to be swinging a little bit. I'm Johnny Negative here at the end of the show, but it seems to be swinging a little bit against Amazon lately. And you know, there's been some good reporting on the ill effects of Amazon in poorer communities, and you can argue whether or not Chicago is one of those. But I think we haven't really discussed enough what the implications of us getting an Amazon H2 would be, and it's starting to trickle up to the surface.
And this week was the first where there was a lawsuit that was filed to essentially force the city and the state to be transparent with what was the offer. Because up to this point, they've just been, no, we're not going to tell you what it is. That's crazy, right? All right, what do you got? Randy, what do you got for
You know, I thought long and hard about this, and I really, to answer the question honestly, I feel like it's weak that nothing that happened this week will be talked about in 50. I mean, despite how interesting our conversation was tonight, and I think it was, I really don't feel like anything consequential came from our state, our city, our nation that anybody will care about in 10 years.
You sound like you need a support animal.
I don't. I mean, I really don't think. I mean, and that says something. I mean, they'll replay State of the Unions as one of the longest ones ever, but I can't think of any clips that will show.
Well, I thought this week, and I had this on my list somewhere else, and I'll adapt it, the Mars rover selfie.
Great photo.
A great photo of, and I think what it was is it reminded us that those were still working and operational. I'm going to have one of the scientists on coming up in the next week, but oh my, those things were supposed to die. They were supposed, the rovers were 90-day lifespan. Some of these are, I mean, this one that took the selfie today was launched in 2011. And to have 7 years of space exploration and to be able to still get a quality selfie from these rovers and to see the planet, I think that we're going to start to see more, I think, more looking at that planet as a planet that could be used for some sort of human capacity. I don't mean living on or anything like that, but it's just amazing how far science has gone to the point that there are pictures that are awesome quality of its planet. I was blown away. I was showing my son today. I'm like, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. It's crazy that right now we're watching it like the next feed's going to be Kim Kardashian. Yep. You know, but right now here's planet Mars.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Just imagine when the Tesla's up there.
Exactly, riding around. Mm. Lots of great stuff. People text in saying the NFL denying the AmVets taking out their ad in the Super Bowl program. That was a story. 630 says at least animals have tickets. What kind of security do we have with the woman who keeps getting on planes without a ticket? That's true.
A great question.
That is such a great question. There's so much good stuff. Craig Newman, Randy Velasomo, reloading this week's news. Guys, great to see you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. Thanks, Jen. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Mavis Staples joins us. The longtime soul singer, once with Staple Singers, of course, soundtrack for the civil rights movement. She's going to be at the Vic Theater tomorrow night. She joins us to talk about her career and her latest album, which was written and produced by Jeff Tweedy from Wilco. We'll talk with Mavis Staples coming up at 10 o'clock hour. Well, coming up on Sunday, the Illinois Holocaust Museum will open a new exhibit called Speak Truth to Power, Human Rights Defenders Who Are Changing Our World. It's the Midwest debut of photographs that highlight human rights defenders from over 40 countries and six continents. It's the work of Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Eddie Adams and my next guest, Carrie Kennedy. Kennedy spent years interviewing activists for her book, Speak Truth to Power, which is what the exhibit's based on. Kennedy is the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and a tireless advocate for international human rights. She continues the work of her family and her famous father, who died 50 years ago this year. Carrie Kennedy will be on hand for the opening of the exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum on Sunday, 1 o'clock start, and she joins me now. Ms. Kennedy, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Great to be on. Thank you so much.
So let's talk about this, because this is, of course, based on your book, but, you know, and this is the Midwest premiere of this exhibit. Talk about why you chose photographs and talk a little bit about bringing the exhibit to Chicago.
You know, this is an exhibit of photographs from the interviews, as you mentioned, with people who are the bravest people on earth, people who face imprisonment, torture, sometimes even death for basic rights most of us take for granted. And there are people like Elie Wiesel, who, of course, survived the Holocaust as a child. And in that interview, he said, "My dream for the future is that your children won't have my past."
Wow.
And there are people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the great anti-apartheid leader from South Africa, who said, "We don't have a God who says, 'Ah, gotcha.' We have a God who lifts us up and dusts us off and tells us to try it again." And to me, those are really the bookends of human rights. On the one hand, trying to stop the atrocities, and on the other hand, having this faith in the capacity of the human spirit to triumph even under the worst of circumstances.
There's something really great. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's something really great about the photography and choosing in a way to have this exhibit, to choose portraits like this or portrait photography, to be able to see the faces of people who are behind the scenes, who are trying to save human beings. Well, to talk about the idea of putting them front and forward like that and being able to showcase what they look like.
Well, I think, you know, it's important to put a face to all of these names, exotic names from foreign countries, Bung Bung Wijianto, and, you know, and others who we can barely pronounce and can't find on a map. But they're really the living embodiment of courage, of standing up and for the greater good for our communities. And I want to exhibit these because they're not saints that are, you know, sealed in stained glass, but they're living, breathing human beings among us. And they remind each of us of our own courage and of our own capacity to make a difference and to stand up.
Yeah, and I think about the work of what you're doing, but also the Illinois Holocaust Museum. And of course, when you're talking about human rights, it's something that obviously we've seen throughout history, where we've seen violation after violation. And even in our recent, we were just had a conversation with Wendy Perlman on the program about Syria and the refugees and the human rights violations that continue, even though everybody in America thinks that the war is over or things are back to normal. That's not the case. For you and your position at the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, is that part of what this is about? Is about educating people, about almost promoting the fact that there still needs work to be done at all time?
Absolutely. You know, when people ask what's the biggest human rights issue facing our world today, for me, that's easy. The answer is hate. And that's what ties together the Boko Haram in Nigeria, ISIS in Iraq and Syria, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, the rise of those in Europe, the hate that we've heard spewed by political leaders here in the United States and the Rohingya in Myanmar. So we've seen this, and this is also, of course, part of the Me Too movement. So I think these are important issues to raise, but you don't need a passport to work on these issues. I think if you go into almost any school, middle or high school in the United States, you're going to hear words like retard or fatso or many other much more odious words. Mm-hmm. And kids are 20, 30 times a day between their school and social media. And each time they see that or hear that, they have to make a decision. Am I going to stand up or am I going to go along? And each time they make that decision, it's like they're exercising a muscle. And eventually that becomes the go-to muscle, and they don't even think twice about it by the time they become an adult. So this exhibit is really showing how to stand up and how to start thinking about that in our own lives, in our everyday lives. How do we confront hate? How do we talk to our friends when our friends are telling racist jokes or sexist jokes? Sometimes it's harder to confront your friends than it is to confront your enemies.
That's well said, especially when you think that when we talk about human rights violations or even atrocities, they're almost designed to feel like they're from somewhere else, that they may be in a country in a faraway land that we're not familiar with, or maybe we watched on the news or in a documentary, but it's not happening where we live. But as you just stated, things like bullying or even in the Me Too movement, harassment, those are of the same tree. Those are human rights violations.
Absolutely. And we see that also in the criminal justice system, which we're all part of because it's part of our government, where there is so much race-based imprisonment and arrests and et cetera. So I think this is an issue that we face as a greater society, and something that we have to confront within ourselves, within our families, within our communities, and really try and make a difference on.
The exhibit is called Speak Truth to Power, Human Rights Defenders Who Are Changing Our World. It's at the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie. It's in the Midwest premiere or debut of photographs that highlight human rights defenders from 40 countries, 6 continents. Kerry Kennedy wrote the book and is part of and bringing this this to Chicago, to the Skokie area. She's going to be on stage at 1:00 on Sunday. Ms. Kennedy, when we talk about being the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Organization, the foundation, when you are tasked with taking on human rights violations here and abroad, what are some of the tools at your disposal? I mean, what is the foundation doing? Is it just about promotions, just about education? Or are there things that you do and you put your resources to that are special and unique for the foundation?
So we approach human rights in 3 ways. Number one, we sue governments. So when Uganda passed a law that made homosexuality punishable by life in prison without parole, we partnered with local lawyers on the ground and sued the government and overturned that law. So we do that all over the world, particularly in Latin America and in Africa. Mm-hmm. And then domestically here at home, we're really looking at mass incarceration and pretrial detention. But today, of the 100 largest economies on earth, 50% of them are corporations. So Walmart has a bigger economic footprint, for instance, than the country of Norway.
Wow.
So today, if you're really interested in being involved in human rights, you need to engage the corporate sector.
Absolutely.
And we do, yes. And so we do that through investors in those corporations. So, for instance, we'll work with a union pension fund on how companies that it is investing in treat people at the bottom of the supply chain. Issues like that. Another issue that we work on with investors is who's making the investments. So you might be surprised to learn that in the 20 largest college endowments in the United States, only 1% of those endowments are invested by women and minority-owned firms. I mean, it's
that
really
is surprising. Yep, I
shocking.
Think it is shocking, and I. It's such an interesting way to think about it when you think about corporations having larger economic footprints than nations, especially nations that we know to have human rights violations. And you think about some of the violations that come for low pay or no benefits or harassment or no policies when it comes to protecting workers. You're absolutely right that there needs to be maybe more of a worldwide look at the way that this is happening. Corporations are working in our country and around the world to be able to be in a position where we can suss out human rights violations in the future.
Exactly. So then we believe if we hold governments responsible and we hold corporations responsible, it's for naught if we don't get the next generation of human rights defenders in line. And that's how where our human rights education program comes in. And that's why we're so excited to be here at the Illinois Holocaust Museum starting on Sunday and going through the end of June.
Carrie, I'm interested, you know, when I think about this issue, because, you know, obviously suing governments, as you just mentioned about, you know, death penalty and homosexuality and things that might be way outdated when it comes to just human, you know, human society. You know, in this country, we fall back on it as well, and we talk about things like religious freedom or religious liberty, and how some of the teachings of religion will direct people in certain ways. And I think about, even when we talk about corporations, obviously it may not be religion, but it might be business creed, it might be the government in the way that they say this is what we want from what's important, profit's important. So how do you deal with the facts? The factors like religion and government when you're trying to change the course of culture?
Well, most of the countries in the world have voluntarily signed on to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Universal Covenants on Human Rights. So it's not that we are imposing on a country. Those countries, those governments representing their people have already said these are rights that we believe every human being has just as virtue as by virtue of being a human being. And therefore, we can hold those governments accountable. And we can, where the governments are failing to implement those laws and those norms, we can hold corporations accountable for their failures as well. And that's the lens through which we see this.
My last question, just, you know, as you of course being a Kennedy and from a family that has dedicated itself to public service from generation to generation, how important is, does that guide you as someone who gets into the business of human rights and making sure that it spreads across the world, being a part of a family that has been so high profile on this issue?
Well, you know, absolutely. These are our family values, and they've been passed on from one generation to the next. And I'm very proud of my brothers and sisters. Of course, my brother Christopher here in Illinois, who's running for governor at the moment, and my nephew Joe. I don't know if you saw his yes. retort.
I was going to ask you, how did that make you feel watching him up there?
just so proud of both of them. So proud of both of them and all the hard work that they've given their whole lives to for our country and for our world. But you know, these are the idea of public service, the idea of working for the community is something that's so important to our family, but so important to so many American families. And people in our country has a long history of self-sacrifice for the greater good. And I think that's really the greatest strength of our country.
Carrie Kennedy is the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights. She's also the author of Speak Truth to Power, which is also now an exhibit, or has been an exhibit. It's Midwest debut, Speak Truth to Power, Human Rights Defenders Who Are Changing Our World, is on display starting Sunday at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. Carrie Kennedy will be there for a 1 o'clock event, and the exhibit is going to run at the museum in Skokie through June. Ms. Kennedy, thanks for taking some time out to talk to us now. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
I'm in on the snowstorm. I'm in. I'm right there. Why not, right? Download here, 720 WGN. Carrie Kennedy. That was going to be my last question. So were you were impressed by your nephew giving the Democrat response? And she jumped in on me. I was like, oh.
Then you could have said, was it drool or was it chapstick?
It's a two-part question. One, was it drool or chapstick? And actually, A, were you impressed with your nephew? And B, on the other side, are you disappointed with your brother in running for governor, being in third place?
Yeah. So there's still a lot of time left.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Just look at the Super Bowl last year, right? 28-3. That's essentially what the score is right now. Well, I liked it. Interesting. I liked her a lot. That I'd never thought of human rights violations and the atrocities that happen when it comes to human rights as in the corporate lens, with the corporate lens, right? I mean, when you think about it, I'm not trying to be a corporatist, you know, but there is something to be said that, you know, we see it all the time and we actually call it, I think we call it out, don't we? Like when it's, when we get the human rights violations in Asia, when it comes to making cell phones or making t-shirts and child labor or human rights violations, that gets called out. And there's, of course, a lot of consternation and a lot of pressure on those governments and those corporations to change the way they do things, whether that works or not, I don't know. But when you think about our own companies and the big companies, when you think about some of the companies that have bigger economic footprints than small countries, and they have rampant sexual harassment or issues with pay, they may not be the same human rights violations that you and I may think about. You know, we already think about, you know, kids that are 8 years old making sewing t-shirts for the Super Bowl losers, you know, or whatever it is. And, you know, they're working 24 hours, sleep at the, you know, that's when you think about human rights violations, or when governments mistreat civilians, like in Syria, where they gas their own people, or of course atrocities like the Holocaust. But if you recalibrate your lens and say, well, it may not be, it doesn't have to be that kind of atrocity. It could be, where do we draw the line when it comes to what's a violation? And if it's rampant, if it's something where you are continuing to have these issues and they just go unaddressed because the government's not really going to get involved and it's a corporation and they make money and that's what their job is to do. Can the traditional human rights organizations like the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Foundation get involved with that kind of stuff? I never thought of them to be, you know? I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. Because it's true. I always think of, when I think of this, even this segment, I was thinking about, you know, rural African countries or Bangladesh, you know, or some of the words where we as Americans think that atrocities and violations happen. And to recalibrate and think that bullying or sexual harassment or the issues that are happening in our country fall under the same purview, it does make you, it's like shifting a paradigm where you automatically are like, huh. 847 says the Kennedys, especially the men, have exploited women for many years. That's human rights violation. All right. And if we're honest, that should be mentioned. I don't know if they're saying I'm dishonest for not mentioning it, but I don't know if I would be like, speaking of human rights violations, it's rumored. Sure. But there's some, I mean, yes, I don't think that's human rights violations, but I think I wonder at with the Kennedy name and you know, when you dedicate yourself to public service and you're constantly in, you know, in pursuit of being civil servants, and your personal life and your private life doesn't match up with that, you're open to people being able to call that out, right? I mean, that's what's been the issue for that family. I don't know. I mean, because you also have a pursuit to be a politician. Once was a noble thing. A pursuit to be a politician is now met with, what are you really trying to do? Oh, you're really trying to scam, right? It used to be a noble profession. I would assume I'm only assuming, I wasn't around, but maybe in the 50s and 60s that it wasn't so as much as, who are you trying to get one up on over, you know, like when President Kennedy and things like that. But, you know, so there's something to be said that could change. But I think it is interesting that a family, and it's closest, we talked about, it's funny, we had a lot of Kennedy stuff on this week. So we talked about the Rose Kennedy play, Rose, earlier. But when you talk about a family as close to getting to American royalty as possible, it's the Kennedys. And you think about think about the kismet of this week where we talked about Rose, and then on Tuesday, I didn't even know that it was going to be a Kennedy giving the Democrat response. And then there was another thing about Kennedy on Wednesday. Oh, the Bay of Pigs play that Will Davis is doing, the American Theater Company, was all about Kennedy. And then we have Kerry Kennedy on the show. Chris Kennedy came up in the I mean, it's a lot of Kennedys. And so as much as I continue with the storyline of, they're no longer royalty, I talked about them 8 times this week. Not on purpose. Just in the way of art and news and what they're doing, civil service, things like that. They just came up in story. So you're absolutely right to think that they're still American royalty. Yeah. Speaking of American royalty, Mavis Staples, coming up after the news. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow night at the Vic Theater, a legend will take the stage. I'm talking about the one, the only, Mavis Staples.
If all I was black, looking at you, you might look past all the love I give. If all that feeling got left behind, I'd worry about you.
What's in your mind?
I'd never live my life.
Are you wasting my time?
Oh, I won't be afraid.
I won't be afraid.
If that's how you wanna stay.
How you wanna stay?
I've got love.
Mavis Staples is an award-winning soul and gospel vocalist who was part of the famed Staples Singers. She had a tremendous solo career as well. Her latest album is her 16th. It's called If All I Was Black. It was put out in 2017, and it was written and produced by Jeff Tweedy from Wilco. Mavis has also guested on several songs and albums in the last decade, becoming a go-to for artists like Tweedy, M. Ward, Nico Case, just to name a few. And of course, you can hear her music sampled by many other artists like Ice Cube and Salt-N-Pepa. But Mavis is much more than the music. She was born here in Chicago. She's become a voice for the civil rights movement, and she's an actress who's been on countless TV shows and films, and she was a subject for the 2015 documentary Mavis. Like I said, Mavis Staples coming to the Vic tomorrow night, but tonight she's my guest. Mavis Staples, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Right away, I was watching some of the documentary stuff you've talked about. At an early age, you started touring. You're just 60 plus years of touring and performing. What does it mean to, you know, 60 plus years later, be in a position to play in Chicago?
It means the world to me. You know, I never thought when we first started singing that I would be singing till now. We were more or less singing for our own livelihood. You know, we were passing time. And we happened to sing at a church. And the lady, Vivian Carter, was there from a VJ Records. That's what got us started, you know. But I know, I've known all along, we had a very unique sound, which came from Pops. When he started us singing, he gave us voices that he and his brothers and sisters would sing when they were in Mississippi. Mm. And that was just, nobody was sounding like that, you know. And in fact, when we first started on the road, we did our first, people thought we were old people. And we were just little tiny tots, little stair steps, you know. When we'd get to places, they'd say, "These are children." And Pops would say, "Yeah, they're my children." But I just feel so good that I'm still wanting to be heard. It blows my mind sometimes that the offers and the calls that we get for me to, I work all year, and my audiences are some of my older people, hippies, you know, and I can spot them in the audience. I can spot them. And then here lately, I've been getting some teeny boppers, you know.
Wow.
The teenagers.
That's amazing. I have to ask, just, you know, with your voice and how it's cultivated over the years from the Staple Singers to where you're at now as a solo, as a legend, as someone who commands the stage and gets all these offers from musicians. It's interesting to think that the music that you were producing with Pops and all of what was happening in the 60s is the music that contemporary artists today, they want that sound. They're looking for that sound.
That's,
I mean, they go to the authentic, to the original to get it.
They do. I've been asked a plenty of times from the artists, the rock singers, how can we get the, you know, it's just a three-part harmony that we're doing. Like I say, it's all because of Pops. When we first started at the same time, people didn't know what we were singing. They thought we were country singers. You know, we hadn't ever heard any country music. And the good part of our lives that we just continued to go all over the globe. We were invited to blues festivals, to folk festivals, jazz festivals.
Right.
And I would ask Pops, I said, "Daddy, why are these people inviting us to blues festivals? We don't sing no blues." And he said, "Mavis, you listen to our, you go back and listen. And you listen real good. You will hear some of every kind of sound in our music." And lo and behold, I heard it. I said, "Well," and at the same time, listen, Justin, Pops would really, the blues would show me the blues. Pops was playing the blues on his guitar while we were singing gospel. And we didn't know, my sisters and I didn't realize that Daddy was playing the blues.
Wow.
He learned from, you know, this blues guy in Dockery's Farm.
It's true. And I think, and look at the canon of your work, even in contemporary times, you've played blues festivals and jazz festivals. You are sort of a music chameleon in the way that you could play so many different places. When Jeff Tweedy or M. Ward or other musicians come forward, are they writing music for you, meaning they're kind of going to your sound, or are you changing your sound to meet them? How does it work?
No, I don't change my sound. They get on my program. You know, actually, whatever they play, if it's good for me, I'll sing it. Very, very seldom anyone presents me something that is not fitting for me, because they actually study me. Prince, when Prince was writing for me, now Prince would write from my letters that I would write to him. Every song on the album, The Voice, where he wrote all the songs, especially for me, they are my letters. The songs are my letters. Jeff Tweedy, the first album we did together, he walked through the studio with his headphones on, and I said, "What are you listening to?" He said, "Mavis, you'd be surprised."
What was he listening to?
He was listening to the Staple Singers.
That's great.
And that's when he said, "Mavis, I think, well, how would you like to sing some of these songs that you and your father?" I said, "Oh, man, I would love to sing some of my father's songs." And we turned out, we put three songs on that album, which was Too Close, The Downward Road Is Crowded, and You Don't Knock, You Just Walk On In.
Wow.
Yeah, Jeff Tweedy. Jeff Tweedy, you know, I can't hardly call him Jeff. I called him Tweety. When somebody said Jeff something, I don't know who they're talking about, really. But he would let me know. He said, Mavis, I've listened to your music since I was 18 years old. You know, he said, I love the Staple Singers. He said, I have worked at a record shop. And he had access to our music, and he would listen to it every day. You know, I said, well, that's great. I'm glad you like, he would write songs, his songs. One song he was writing, I said, Tweety, that sounds like something Pops wrote. And he said, really? Well, let me keep on writing.
It's so great. It's so awesome to hear these stories. Mavis Staples, my guest, the legend. She's on stage at the Vic tomorrow night. You know, I think about... It's great to hear that we have such refined musicians who want to go back and study the music, Staple Singers, others. You guys were, as I mentioned, the soundtrack to civil rights movement, freedom movement here in this country. When you were a young girl, did you know that? Did you know that you would have this place in American history as being the soundtrack to a movement?
Oh, no. No, I didn't. I was so young, a lot of times I was just having fun. I was just happy to be singing. And I really... didn't start realizing how strong our music was and how powerful this was, this job that we were doing, until I met Dr. King, you know, and we started singing our songs. We would sing before he would speak, and I would listen to him speak in those meetings that we would have, and it just go all through me. And I said, shucks, we're doing something important. These songs that we're singing, you know, I started even paying more attention to our lyrics. When we would write, Freedom's Highway, March Up Freedom's Highway, Made Up My Mind, and I Won't Turn Around, you know, and then Why Am I Treated So Bad? We would write songs around what was happening in the world. And this Why Am I Treated So Bad was written for the Little Rock Nine, the nine children trying to integrate Central High School down there in Little Rock. And I tell you, I was just so honored. About 3 months ago, I sang for the Little Rock Nine.
Wow.
Yeah, in Little Rock. And I met them. I remembered them. I remembered their names. And it was just an honor to meet those. They were my age when they were trying to integrate that school.
Yeah, that's...
You know, so we sing songs that Pops used to tell the songwriters, if you want to write for the Staple Singers, read the headlines. We want to sing about what's happening in the world today. And if there's something going wrong, we want to try to sing a song to fix it. They started writing. Homer Banks down in Memphis, Tennessee, Homer, he wrote so many good songs for us, you know. And they were all around what was going on.
You know, you have a place in American history, obviously, for the work that Staple Singers did and being the soundtrack for the Civil Rights Movement and your relationship with Dr. King. But you also have this tremendous relationship with Chicago. I think of, you know, being from Chicago, the musicians that you have been involved with or been inspired by, Mahalia Jackson, Curtis Mayfield, a soul movement and a gospel movement in Chicago that in 2018, I'm not sure that many people are saying, oh, Chicago's a soul town or Chicago's a gospel town just because of how far we moved from it. But how does it feel to you to be part of what almost a central focus when I mention those names, Curtis and Mahalia and Mavis Staples? What does it mean to you to be a Chicago music icon?
Oh, it's the greatest feeling. It's the greatest feeling in the world. You know, I knew the ones that are passed on, like Sam Cooke and Johnny Taylor and Pookie Hudson, Sister Mahalia Jackson, Albertina Walker, and Roberta Martin. There were so many. Curtis Mayfield, the impression, Jerry Butler, you know, and I grew up with Sam Cooke and his brothers. We went to the same grammar school, a Doolittle, and we all lived down in the dirty 30s. But it was like a melting pot of music in Chicago. Willie Dixon, you got Coco Taylor, all these got Buddy Guy. Chicago was the place. And I think what happened was, you know, there was some show enough good singing down in Mississippi. You know, down in the bottom. And this is where everybody would migrate from Mississippi to Chicago. So that's how all of the really good music landed, I think, in Chicago.
Yeah, you're right.
you can't take it away from us. You know, I was born here. I was born into it. And my sisters and my brother and I, we used to live on the west side. We would go up to Roosevelt Road and peeping. These blues singers would be up there, Howlin' Wolf and Jimmy Reed. We would, it would be cracks in the walls in this club. We would peep through. And boy, that was the best music you wanted to hear. Yeah. I tell you.
Mavis, tomorrow night at the Vic, when you are headlining a show, and I mean, are you going with the new stuff? How much do you play some of the old stuff? Talk about what a Mavis Staples show looks like in 2018.
Justin, we have to sing some of the old. And that's what we do. We sing the old and the new. So when you all come in tomorrow night, expect, you know, I'll probably start, and I will. I'll tell that much. I'll start with, if you're ready. If you're ready now, come go with me. And we do Respect Yourself.
Wow.
We do a lot of the we can't get away from them because they're the songs that brought us this far.
Yeah.
And we do Why Am I Treated So Bad. Then we've got, see, I have so many new songs that Tweety has written, that Prince wrote. Pops, Do It Again, Curtis Mayfield. When Curtis told Pops, he said, Pops, he gave me my part. He said, now, Pops, this is your part. And that was, I like you, lady, so fine with your pretty hair. Pops said, Curtis, man, I'm not going to say that. I'm a church man. I'm not going to say it. Curtis said, oh, Pops, the Lord won't mind. So we got Pops to say, my sisters and I, we wanted to hear our voice on the big screen, you know.
Yeah.
So we pulled Pops on around.
Well, I have to say, I am just honored. I'm beaming to be able to talk with you. Mavis Staples on stage tomorrow night at the Vic Theater. Her latest album, which was produced and written by Jeff Tweedy, is called If All I Was Was Black.
Yeah.
Grammy Award winner, legend, one of the best. Mavis, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us.
Oh,
we appreciate
it. Thank you for having me on the download.
Somebody opened a window in this studio. We're in the Michigan Avenue studio. It's like,
yeah.
It has dropped 10 degrees in the last half an hour. Oh, woe is me. The next half hour will be about my temperature. It just feels like I can feel the draft, but I don't know where it's coming from. So I'm like standing in the studio trying to find where the jet stream is coming from.
Should we get Kerry Kennedy back on the line? We can
see if...
some sort of human rights violation.
Some sort of violation happening here. This is just in from the Washington Post.
It's a 9 o'clock date tonight. So it was about an hour ago. So Justice Department told court of sources' political influence in the request to wiretap Carter Page. So essentially, one of the things that was inferred by the Devin Nunes memo was that the FBI tried to dupe the judge by not telling that the information from the Steele dossier could have been purchased for political purposes. Well, they came forward, and it seems to be two officials, U.S. officials familiar with the matter, have said that the court was aware that some of the information underpinning the warrant request was paid for by a political entity. So that did not the whole premise of the memo was that they were trying to dupe the judge because they were corrupt and they were for Democrats. But they didn't, according to these sources, it could be bogus, fake news, whatever it might be. We don't know. But the reporting of the Washington Post says that the judge knew in doing it and was part of, so there was no dupe that they put forward. So that kind of undermines the credibility of that memo in a way. But then again, tomorrow there'll be a piece that undermines that, and then another piece to undermine that, and so on and so forth until the 2020 election. it's a little ridiculous, but I don't know. I don't know what's a bombshell anymore. All I know is I feel bad for Geraldo. I've heard 30 references to the Al Capone vault today, unfortunately, for Geraldo. I just feel, hey, you can never live it down. It's always got
to
be around.
Yeah, it's going to be.
Yep.
Weapon is hot. I remember he used to say that. Weapon is hot.
Did you watch that? Were you a kid watching the Al Capone
vault? I vaguely remember it.
It's a big deal. Even though I don't think I was really into Al Capone, but it was just this idea that
they made it into an event.
Yeah, amazing. And then we were all as one, as a generation, introduced to, at the same time, let down by the beginning of cable news. There was something about that where we're like, oh, this is going to be news now. This is how news is going to be. Well, at least we now know. That's so true, right? It's like, so there's nothing? They just talked about nothing for 2 hours? Oh, there's some executives like, I like it. I know everyone's making fun of it, but I think we've got a format. That's how it went down. All right, coming up after the news, I want to talk about the Super Bowl. You know, I want to talk about whether or not I should watch this game. If you have advice for me, you can let me know. Jen, Pete, you can talk me off the ledge one way or the other. I don't know, but the 312-981-7200, this may be the year that I just skip the Super Bowl. So I have that conversation coming up. Thanks, Jen and Roger. It's interesting. I feel bad because, the more traffic jams on a Friday night maybe means they're like, well, you know what? I'll just put on 720 while I wait it out. now that all the expressways are wide open, now, you're competing at home. Then it becomes, I can check out the new Tupac movie that's on HBO.
Is that real?
It's good. I saw it. It's called All Eyes on Me. It was in the theaters over the summer, and it's a biopic of Tupac.
I have a feeling this is going to be your winter Huey. Remember when you read Huey, the Vietnam War book?
The Vietnam War book that I read over the summertime.
Everything in some way is going to be related back to Tupac.
That's absolutely right. It's going to be all about Tupac. I don't know if you've seen, Jen, have you seen the NWA movie? That was out last year, 2 years ago?
Oh, yeah, I did.
I saw that. And maybe there was a couple years ago the Notorious B.I.G. movie that was out.
I don't know if I saw that.
All those are so cheesy. They're so cheap. They're like, am I going to be something? Is this, and then like, or like, Easy, I'm coughing. I don't know why I'm coughing, Dre. And you're like, all right. Like, it's so cheesy and hokey, and I kind of didn't want to watch the Tupac movie, and it's on HBO now, and mm-hmm. last night I couldn't get to bed, so I'm like, all right, let's see what this is about. And it starts off right away with Tupac Shakur's mom getting out of jail. She's a Black Panther in the 70s, and she has this speech that you wouldn't give on the steps of a, you know, a reporter comes up and goes, how do you feel? And she has this great monologue that you're like, that's not a quote. That never happened. But then she goes, and I only have hope for the soul that is growing inside me. And she grabs her belly and she's pregnant. I'm like, all right. All right. We get it. That's Tupac. We get it. But when they got there, I have to say, where they won me over. The first part of it, him growing up, how bad his life was. He was running. The cops were always shaking down his mom. And it was just, oh, geez. It was everything pretty cliche. But they got to the point where he went to Oakland and he had a chance to meet a guy. He got introduced to Shock G, who is the front man for Digital Underground, the guy who does Humpty Dance with the nose. And so he's like, and he became part of Digital Underground. That was like the beginning of Tupac. A lot of people don't know he was in Digital Underground. He was in Humpty Dance.
Wow.
Before he became a gangster rapper, he was doing that. And so it was just hilarious to watch that story like be recreated, the beginnings of Humpty Dance. I was like, now I'm in. Oh, they're doing the recreation of Humpty Dance.
I think you just sold me on this movie.
Right? And then it gets real deep after that, because he gets shot a bunch of times. And
I mean, I still love his music, but that was probably the soundtrack to my teenage years, you know?
Oh, getting an inside look to the rebel that is Jen DeSalvo.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. All right. I tried to learn all the words, but you know.
I had a friend who had the double record, because there's the, mm-hmm. the greatest hits double record
yep.
and a CD, and we worked together, and I remember she had it, and I'm like, can I borrow that? Because I had a CD player in my car, and she's like, it's my sister's, and I'm like, is there any way I can have it? I still have it.
Oh, wow.
Like, I promised. I was like, oh, don't, it's like a day, and I'll give it back. I'm going on a car ride, and I just want to listen to Tupac, and I still have it. That was 20 years ago.
I think you owe somebody a CD.
I know, right? Not a good move on my part. But yes, I am going to be... the movie ends, I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but the movie ends with Tupac getting shot and killed, right? That's, of course, happened in this...
Oh, wait.
I don't want a spoiler alert that he's not alive anymore.
Nobody knows that.
Right.
Okay.
And but that's it. There's no... They don't... It's still... They flash up a couple of words at the end, like Tupac was killed 6 days later. He died in the hospital. His... murder is still unsolved 21 years later or whatever. And I'm like, what? There's one thing that you would want to solve. It would be, who killed this dude?
They don't want to solve it because he's on an island somewhere with Elvis and Michael Jackson, right? They're all right. Hanging out, eating peanut butter banana cupcakes.
Yeah, maybe you're right. There is a theory that he might still be alive. And it might be this actor, because the actor looks exactly like Tupac. I mean,
oh,
he
wow.
looks exactly like him. It's pretty, it's uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so anyway, that was what I'm all on a Tupac kick now. So if anyone wants to, and I mean, any other things I could tell you about them, if you have any questions, audience, I could tell you about. If you don't want to watch the movie, I did watch the movie, so
look at those phones not light up, Justin.
If you have questions about what happened in the first act, maybe second act, what his relationship was like in prison, how his relationship with his mom evolved as they became adults.
All Tupac, all the time.
All Tupac, all the time.
Oh, did you hear that?
This morning I made the mistake where my son was in the car. They were off school today, so I took him in, and I'm like, oh, you know, I got so intrigued by the music. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to listen to some Tupac. So I pulled it up on my Apple Music.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with, you know, like, all eyes up. Nope, can't use that one.
Yeah.
Oh, no, can't do that one.
None of them.
Can't do that one. I mean, it's just like every single Tupac song that's on there has the parental guidance or the E explicit all the way down. 80 songs are all there. I'm like, there's not even a radio edit to find.
Yeah, or an instrumental. Any instrumental jams you can find.
I was going to say, I think they had radio edits, but they were like a minute and 5 seconds long.
Yeah, and they were also the radio edits. I found one. The radio edits of a Tupac song in the 90s
uh-huh.
is much different than the radio edits of today. They're record scratching
mm-hmm.
over his stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so you're just like, all right, this doesn't work. They've just determined to... This is before they figured out how to flip the word. So the swear word was backwards.
Yeah.
that's a Pete Zimmerman move.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's they don't do that. This is just record scratch. you know, it's like I get around, and it's like I get around, I get, and you're like, all right, this, you're taking me out of it. I'm out. So yeah, again, if anyone wants to know anything about Tupac, I got it down. But I didn't realize how there was a lot of books about him after the fact. You know who wrote a book? Michael Dyson. Is it Michael Eric Dyson?
Michael Eric Dyson, yeah.
He wrote a book about Tupac. And there was all this movement, and I remember working at, when I was working at NPR, about so many people would pitch this idea that they wanted to talk, you know, after his life about how important he was as a leader, an African-American leader. And I was always like, all right, it seems a lot like of intellectualizing a gangster rapper, right? At a certain point, you're like, okay, there's a lot of evidence to show that he was an artist and he didn't really, he wasn't a prophet. He wasn't the person who stood in front. But watching the movie, and I get that it's a fictionalized version, it's not a documentary, but I didn't recognize how true that was. Like that, through the stuff I saw on MTV News when I was a teenager and the stuff that maybe you got from the music and you liked it was always there. And that was what I saw as, and not necessarily a huge fan of Tupac when I was growing up. And I didn't really go behind it to think about all the stuff that he was preaching and talking to the media about. He would just have these long press conferences with microphones in his face, but you never got to see that stuff because it wasn't the internet yet. And most of the press conference stuff was when he did something bad and coming out of a courthouse or something, and on MTV News. The regular news didn't even treat him with respect. It was more like, gangster rap is a problem, and the guy who's creating it is right here. And it wasn't necessarily, no one actually tried to get to his voice at all. That's, again, this is a fictionalized movie about how great he was. So,
anyway. Except for Kurt Loder.
Yeah, right.
The only person
Loder has a, like, there's a cameo of him, like, you know, like, today, like, the actual footage of him being like, Tupac was shot 5 times in a, you know, lobby of a recording studio in New York. They did that kind of stuff. They also have, at the end of the movie, they do this thing where he starts a fight in Las Vegas after a Mike Tyson fight.
Mm-hmm.
He starts a fight with somebody in the casino, and then it's an hour later that he's shot and killed on the strip.
Oh.
And so there's a question about the prevailing thought, not the conspiracy theory, but the police thought, is that he just picked a fight with a thug who returned favor with bullets. And the conspiracy theory is that it was the East Coast rappers, right?
Yeah.
That's the concept, but they they can't prove that. But point being that they show they fictionalize it. They have the point where he goes up to a guy, but they also cut in the actual footage of security cameras in the casino showing Tupac going up and starting the fight. So they recreate it fictionally, you know, like for the shot with the actor, but they splice it in with the real shots of him going and doing it, but from a security camera angle. So they kind of cut it back in. I thought that was kind of cool.
Interesting.
Yeah. Again, anyone has any questions about Tupac? As somebody said, 630 or 336 says, two words I never expected in the same sentence, WGN and Tupac. Oh, come on. he's a pop culture icon. I mean, I would think that if he were a pop culture icon in the 80s, that people who talked about pop culture on WGN would talk about Tupac. I don't think that's that far off. But that's what I'm saying. I think that in the way that our society works, somehow Tupac has become this, you know, he's only for one audience. It's only for black people. That's who care about Tupac. But I'm telling you, he was way beyond that. And stuff he was rapping about was not what everyone else was rapping about. But then at the same time, he had a yin and a yang where he'd put out the dirtiest, nastiest song.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be what people were attracted to. But then at the same time, he put out Brenda Got a Baby or y'all, Dear Mama, you know, and those kind of songs. So that was like the dichotomy of this guy. Real interesting. Yeah. See what happens when Justin can't sleep? He gets a good 15-minute segment on Tupac.
We did. We just got 15 minutes on Tupac.
I know. I could go another hour. You see, Patty just wants to chill. If she wants to come in and talk Tupac, she'll talk Tupac.
I'm sure she would, yeah.
I swear. Yeah, I'm totally into it. I'm going to do a lot more. I'm going to go down the rabbit hole on Tupac. I almost had it as my week in review rabbit hole. And then everyone would be like, why? And I'm like, I don't know, because I saw it. They put it on HBO and I watched it. The only problem I had with the movie, 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Ooh.
And I was like, it doesn't need to be that long.
That's longer than Star Wars.
220. But still, should be one. It should be an hour and 20 minutes, right? 30 minutes, and then it's over. But they had to put the extra footage in.
So I don't even remember this coming out in the theaters. Mm-mm. This was a theatrical release?
It was a theatrical release.
And now
release
it's on HBO? Because
the
they're
summer.
Doing promos.
Yeah.
Like it's like a made for HBO movie.
No, it's a real. It was a. Maybe it is a made. Maybe it was.
Or at like one of the independent theaters. Like what is it? Century.
I thought it went out. I could be wrong. You might be right. I mean, maybe after time it changed. It shifted. But I remember seeing the trailer for it.
I mean, they've been pushing it a lot on HBO.
It was after the NWA movie, and then the trailers came out for the Tupac bio. Because it was playing off of that, and it's fun because Snoop Dogg's in it, Suge Knight's in it, like all these main people are in it. Doesn't have a good relationship with Interscope Records, which I thought was with Jimmy Iovine and the documentary. That was another one that I went down that I watched and talked about for 2 weeks. But they, if you watch the Jimmy Iovine documentary on HBO, they act like they were the greatest record label and they loved artists and the whole bit. But then you go from this movie, Interscope is a bad guy, so it's kind of interesting. But again, Death Row Records is Suge Knight.
Well, that NWA movie was straight out of Compton, right? Is that the one?
Yeah.
And that one was up for all sorts of awards, or at least the like SAG Awards last year.
Yeah,
I think it was up
or
for
2 years ago.
Like a screenwriting Oscar. Oscar.
Did it win the Oscar?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I did not. I was the one guy who didn't think that movie was that great. And I liked NWA as a kid. I really did. And I was looking forward to it. But I just kind of felt like I'm not a huge. And there's part of it in this Tupac movie, too, where it just sort of like, you could change the world, Pac.
He did. The world.
Same with the NWA. We're just some kids from South Central. Can you believe it, Dre? And you're like, all right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, dude, just got a new album from, let's check, it just came in. It's from NWA. Let's put it on. Oh, my God, this is a great song. And like, all right, that's not how it happened.
What eye rolls.
Yeah.
They actually got nominated for Best Writing Original Screenplay for Academy Awards.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think the Tupac movie did. Unfortunately.
We're talking about Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, right. Straight Outta Compton, yeah.
The Notorious B.I.G. movie, I think it's called Notorious, and it was done a couple years before this trend. That one's the worst. That's the one. It's the same concept. You can be anything you want to be, Biggie. It's like, all right. It's the same.
Have to slap you over the face.
What if you rapped over some slow songs, Biggie? And it's like, all right, come on, stop it. That never happened.
I hope this is a new a movie that was released like 6 months ago, because I remember I wanted to do a bit where you review. An old movie that's been out.
It did come out 6 months ago.
Because like on Facebook, you'll see like, oh my God, Stranger Things, incredible. And like right now, it's like, come on.
I have, you know what my guilty pleasure is, if we ever do that segment, guilty pleasure, is I will always find on HBO or the free movies. I go to the free movie. HBO is a part of the package, but whatever's free.
Yeah.
And I go to the worst CIA espionage movie. Like the one I just watched with Idris Elba. I couldn't even tell you the name of it, but then there was one with Leonardo DiCaprio. It's always Middle East terrorism.
That's your go-to espionage, huh?
But that's the popcorn stuff that I throw away for an hour and a half.
Your second guilty pleasure is Tupac's greatest hits.
Oh man, and I still got that. I wonder if I can. Yeah, I'm gonna figure out how to jam that this weekend with the kid in the house. It is just explicit. There's no way to do it. Mm-mm. It is so dirty. For no reason. You're just like, all right, there's no reason to put the F word right there. It doesn't even make the song right.
Like, I love the song Troublesome. Just the whole beat to it. It's great to run to, but you can't say any of the words.
Yeah. I know. He is a poet who loves swear words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the Poetry Foundation does the tributes to people, the next one will be Tupac, where they say, and they'll have some pretentious guy up there who will be reading it, but it'll be all swear words.
I will say, though, when I'm at the gym, occasionally Straight Outta Compton, the song will come on in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a weird one for the gym.
But it's like, but it's good because it's upbeat. It's like, straight out of Compton, gentlemen call. They change. It's no MF stuff. It's like totally it. Clean. It's like, this is terrible.
Wow. Yeah.
So, like, wait, your son will, like, he'll discover yeah. Tupac in a couple of years on his own and be yeah. happy about it. And,
when he finds your CD.
Right.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
CDs are like,
when he finds
right?
your CD.
When yeah. CDs are like records to millennials.
Yes, that's so true. My 10-year-old's going to be like, he's going to be cool with a CD collection.
Check out my Discman.
Yeah, he's got the crates and the Discman all tricked out. <He's>
got... Have the ladies over to sip some scotch and listen yeah, to CDs.
Exactly. He'll be like, yeah, this was real hot back in the day. I got it rigged up. Oh, how'd you do so? It's so retro. Yeah. Listen to this one. He's got to spin it a little bit because the thing is broken. He's got to turn it. He's got to blow into it.
Hold on. There's fingerprints. Let me buff it.
Yeah, he's got to buff it. He's got to.
Oh God,
that's great.
Dad left this Tupac CD sitting in his car for too many years. It's yeah. warped.
Well, watch what I can do with it. See, what I do is I rub it with my sweater. I rub it and I blow into it. And you just got to get in there and spin it. There we go. So where were we?
Oh,
want to watch a Tupac movie? 847 says, what a great segment on Tupac. He was great. I loved him. See?
Oh, yeah.
And then the other person's like, I could not identify Tupac if he came and spat on me on the street. Who cares? Why would Tupac spit on you?
He might.
Yeah, maybe, but that's a lot. That's...
He likes to fight with random people.
He does. He did get in fights, casino fights, the worst kind of fight. Why are you getting in a casino fight? And how is that even possible? How do you get let go? That's the one thing. How did Tupac get into a fight where and it's so dramatic where they punch a guy and then they all kick him? There's like 12 people and they get away. And I'm like, there's no way that the three of us can go into a casino and be like, I don't like that guy. Let's kick him and punch him. And they just be like, well, I guess they got away. Right? You know what I mean? Have you ever been in a Vegas casino?
No.
Can't bump
yeah.
into anybody without security being up on you.
Tackled. You're in casino jail. I don't know. I've never been. I'm speaking like I know. Ugh.
You've never been to a Vegas casino?
No, I've never been to Vegas.
Well, I wouldn't. You should go to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And but I'm not sure. I would stop short of saying it's awesome. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's worth seeing because it is so man-made.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk down and you're like, I can't believe they made this. But then it takes about an hour to go, I can't believe they made this.
Unless you get caught up in the gambling. And get like yeah. addicted to it.
Right. Yeah.
It loses its appeal after about 10 minutes
yeah, exactly.
because, first of all, the rooms are like 10 football fields. The lighting is horrible after a couple of minutes,
and the sound
is just ridiculous. And there's a smell
yeah.
in the room.
Yeah, there's a smell.
I remember, I lived there for 3.5 years.
Oh, wow.
Oh, interesting.
Working there.
Yeah, right.
So,
Where did you work?
I worked in radio.
So you worked, but you didn't work on the Strip then. Then you were actually a Vegas town guy.
Yeah, I lived just off the Strip. We lived about 2 blocks behind the Flamingo.
Wow.
For a long time, till our daughter was born. Then we moved all the way out to Boulder Highway before there was anything out there. This was back late 70s.
Well,
this is back in the casino movie times.
That's so
but
good.
I did work at a radio station that was actually in one of the bungalows behind a Strip hotel casino that's not there anymore, the Castaways. And
the Castaways?
Yeah. Long gone. Long gone. And it was an all-news daytimer.
Wow. That's amazing. That's yeah. a good, that's a good, that's a, that's got to be a weird time, Roger.
It was.
2 blocks from the Flamingo.
The town was changing. It wasn't what it is now. It's expanded so much from the time I was there. And the building that our first apartment building is now part of the Flamingo complex.
Wow.
They bought up all that land, tore everything down behind it.
Yeah, they did. Right.
So, it's.
I went to Vegas within the last year. And I will say that I was surprised at how I used to be. There's so much street hawking.
Mm-hmm.
Like people trying to put flyers in your hand
yeah.
and stuff like that. And it has doubled. Now it's gotten to the point where it's guys trying to put rap CDs in your hand and everyone just really getting up in it because they know it's just tourists.
Sure.
And it's just amazing to me that they have that property and they spend so much time to cultivate you spending money in their property that they wouldn't, that the city wouldn't clean that up. Yeah, like make loitering.
Well, the city hasn't done a lot because the city fell on hard times for quite a number of years. The housing crisis hit the hardest in the Las Vegas area across the entire nation. It was the worst there. I'll tell you, back when I was there, you would not find anyone hawking anything in front of any of the casinos.
Yeah, it's weird.
Seriously. It was a very clean town.
Yeah.
It was run by people who grew up in Las Vegas. And the mob was still running stuff back then.
Hey, here's a good example, Roger. You'll get this. That, you know, you get out. That time is a weird thing in Vegas if you're spending a weekend there. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be a Saturday night and maybe it's like 1 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And you're walking by Caesar's Palace to Bally's or Bally's to Paris or whatever it might be, right?
Right.
And you actually have a vibe that you're a little bit scared
mm-hmm.
because there's people on the street that are just hanging out. And they're kind of like, they're always bothering you and they want to get you into a club or they want to give you stuff. And you kind of get this vibe where you're like you're walking downtown Chicago, like you're in Chicago at 1 o'clock mm-hmm. in the morning. And that, I never felt that before. Like when I used to go in 2000s, you felt you were just like the tourists had reign of the place. But the last time I went, I was like, geez, calm down with like following me for a block.
Yeah, it. The last time I was there was maybe about 7-8 years ago for a broadcasters convention, and I saw it there. I saw it then, and it was not the Vegas that I remember at. Not even close.
Well, I smell a new show, or at least a new segment. Yeah. Roger's right? Vegas, right?
Well, you guys can also talk about the homeless population living in the flood tunnels underneath Las Vegas.
Yeah,
I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah. Lots of them.
All right, it could be the Jen and Roger take on Vegas. The whole show. All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez.